Hey, everybody, we are live.
Hey, so I feel like I should acknowledge that if something weird happens, it could be my fault because I have a brand new computer that I'm recording on. Marco, it could be your fault because you have a brand new computer that you're recording on. And it could actually even be John's fault because his computer's so old, busted, ancient, and slow that it could be his fault after all. We don't know. Nobody
I
knows.
think you mean reliable. Slow and steady wins the race.
I see.
Why? But why do you already worry about your computers? There's nothing weird about your computers. That I mean, yes, they are new, but like, do you expect there to be problems? They're not too
Well,
different from the computers you're replacing them.
no,
Or
and we're
that you
jumping
replaced them with.
ahead. We're also jumping ahead, and I need to put the kibosh on this until we get there. But suffice to say, when
We
I
don't
got
want
on
to
the
spoil
call,
the fact that we buy new computers frequently.
right? Well, especially one of us.
Speak for yourself, yeah.
But
Who
in any
has bought
case,
the newest computer here? Oh, you. That's right,
oh,
it's
by a
you.
week. It's like I'm the older twin because I'm 5 minutes older. Anyway, but no, when I got on the call this evening, first thing Marco said to me was, "Oh, you're on the wrong mic," which was true for the record.
I mean, it never happened with the old computer, so you're right. This is a big change.
Jesus. All right, we have to get to that later. We have a lot of other compulsory things to get through first, including some show administrivia, trivia, but this is all good things. A couple of things to go over first. This is your second notice
Second
that
of three.
second of three notices.
Also known
Notices.
as the second to last.
Also true. The
I'm
ATP
warning you with peace
holiday.
and love.
The ATP holiday gifts, whatever store is here at atp.fm/store. Now is the time. And let me remind you, if you are an ATP member, and I assure you, almost all of the cool kids are. There's only a few cool kids left that aren't. So if you're an ATP member that you can join at atp.fm/join, you get for this
By the way, to
sale,
be
this is one
clear,
of.
you can join even if you're not cool.
Also
Just,
true.
yeah,
Also true.
anybody can join.
I think actually by joining, you become cool, and we're not going to do any further research on that. So
Yeah,
we're just going
we're
to
going to
go with
leave
it.
that as a theoretical.
All right. So if you wanted to partake in this, a time limited, as we call it, sale, this is one of those times that you get 15% off anything you buy from the ATP store in this time limited sale. You can go into your member dashboard or whatever we're calling it to get your bespoke discount code that you use at Cotton Bureau. But yes, now is the time to buy gifts for you. Hey, you know what? You know what you should do, Marco? You should treat yourself. You should get yourself a gift. You could have somebody else treat you. You can treat somebody else. Treats all around, I tells you. So, John, can you walk us through what are the wares we have on offer today?
We went through them all last week. The headlining stuff that you need to know is that there's a new shirt where we tried to do the logo out of pixels, which is at the bleeding edge of what is possible on printing. And so that's exciting. Give it a try. Live on the edge with us. And then we have a space black joke shirt where the logo is not quite black, just like the new MacBooks. Then we have a bunch of M3 shirts, which are like the M2 and M1 ones were. We have the ATP 6-color shirt where the shirts come in lots of different colors, but the logo is just white on all of them. That's the main colorful one. Then we have the plain ATP one, the hoodie, the polo, a new mug, and pint glasses. And the only thing I want to add that we didn't mention last week is that the mugs and the pint glasses, unlike the other things, like we have to guess how many we're going to sell of these, and we order them up front in a certain amount, which means that they may run out. So if you want a mug or if you want a pint glass, don't wait because they may run out. And if they run out, that's it. Like we can't get any more in time for anything close to the holidays. So, don't wait on the mugs and the pint glasses. Every time we sell mugs, people send us pictures of all their mugs that they broke, and it's like, be careful. Someone dropped their mug on their iPad
No,
I think it was the
they
other way
dropped
around.
their iPad on their mug.
Oh,
Correct.
either way. So we already know the power of the iPad. It shatters
Indeed.
windshields. It destroys mugs. The iPad is indestructible unless you drop it by itself, and then it shatters.
In all
Right. Right.
fairness,
Correct.
the mug damage on that on the drop incident was actually it was only like a little chip off the side. The mug was mostly intact,
Was a
which
pretty big chip,
I
but
think that
it's
suggests that
got
the mug
patina
might
now.
be more sturdy than windshields.
Oh yeah,
That's
for
true.
sure. Well,
That's
not
true.
wielded by Casey though. We don't know what's the velocities involved here.
Indeed. But yeah, it's just got a patina now, the mug. But yes, we are saying this in part for our own selfish purposes because we want you to buy and buy now, but also really and truly, that isn't a lie. Like we did, I don't remember the quantities, and honestly, I don't know if we'd tell you anyway, but we have limited quantities of the mug and the glass. We should have enough if you order anytime soon. But if you're concerned,
don't wait on those. And the other things you don't have to worry about, but you do have to worry about the sale ending. Again, I worry about people who like who want this, but it's a perfect gift for someone to get you. If you're hard to shop for and people don't know what to get you and you're afraid they're going to get you socks or something, send them this link. Do not be shy. You can't beat around the bush. You can't lay hints. You have to say, look, the sale ends November 26th and I really want one of these things. I know you think it's dumb, but I like this. Like, that's what you have to communicate. Say, I know this stuff looks dumb and expensive, but I like this podcast and this would be a good gift for me. Tell somebody who actually wants to get you a gift, tell them that and send them the link before the sale ends. Mm-hmm. So that's my dire warning.
We also have some breaking news. We've actually added not new designs, but some new other things. John, can you elaborate a little bit for me?
Yeah, please? A couple of people asked, hey, do you have long sleeve versions of these? And I was like, oh, I meant to do that because we did add sweatshirts to a lot of them. Like instead of just t-shirts, a lot of them come in sweatshirt variants. It's the same product. Like the product will be called like ATP Space Black. And that comes in short sleeve t-shirt, sweatshirt, but now also long sleeve t-shirt. Some of them even come in tank tops. Like not every variety is on everything, but think, oh, I don't want a t-shirt, so I don't want to click on that. Click through on the design that you like and see if it's offered in sweatshirt, long sleeve t-shirt, tank top, whatever you want. And we also added youth and kid sizes. We can't do baby sizes for these because they like the whatever the printing process is, the logo is the same color and this logo is too big to fit on a baby. The on-demand ones, I think they can do on babies because that's a different printing process where it's just like, well, I don't know anything about how it works, but I imagine in my head that it's more like an inkjet printer that can print anything, whereas these are like, I don't know, some kind of like pattern that they run ink through or something. Anyway, point is no infants for these, but we do have youths and kid sizes, which are like smaller than adult sizes. And we do have long sleeve tees on several of them and sweatshirts on several of them. So they're good for winter weather. So check them out.
Yep. And as a final note on that, the youth sizes, and I don't think even the boys know this yet, the youth sizes were a request from my beloved wife, Erin, who has said, and I think I'm pretty damn sure she said it jokingly, but she said, you know, when you, the three of you are just swimming Scrooge McDuck style in all of your merch proceeds, because everyone has gotten youth sized tees for their children or a friend's children or what have you, you know, I should thank Erin. So if you would like her to be able to rub something in my face, probably until the end of time, go ahead and buy your friends' kids, your kids, your random kids, throw them in the schools like a t-shirt cannon at a stadium. I'm sure that won't be awkward or get you in trouble at all. Buy some youth sizes too. I believe that's the first time we've offered anything in youth sizes. So the youths, Marco, the youths. All right. Check it out. ATP.fm/store. We also have something else to talk about. We have a new member special. And I don't know, Marco, would you like to take a stab at describing this and then John can correct you?
So, you know, as we've discussed in the show a little bit here and there, in recent months, John has been working on the CMS. And the CMS is something that I wrote in PHP originally. And so John has been learning, well, reluctantly, plowing through PHP. And we thought, what is better content than having John talk about his learning process of learning not only PHP, but learning my totally undocumented framework that is a custom framework that no one else uses, basically. and also, you know, the whole code base to the CMS, which, you know, let's be honest, it was not like, it was never my top priority. So John had to wade through that. And we made him talk about it and recorded it. And I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, the title of it is the more aspirational, my more aspirational goal, which is the title, which were this formative title for our specials I'm rapidly regretting, but now it's kind of becoming a joke, which is something colon and then something else, right? So we do ATP top four for the ones that are like top four format that makes sense, ATP eats for the ones where we eat gross foods, ATP movie club or whatever where we watch movies. This one is ATP dev colon other people's code. And I hope to make it more broadly applicable to like, hey, so you're a software developer. Guess what you're going to be doing? You're going to be looking at other people's code a lot. And what is that like? And obviously the concrete example is I'm looking at other people's code. It's Marco CMS stuff or whatever. But we hope it's more broad than that. If not, you can just hear me. I tried to lay off complaining about PHP too much because like, yeah, whatever, we get it. It's gross. We've had many shows where we've talked about that. But the more applicable thing is like, what is it like not just for programming, but anything. What is it like when you don't get to define everything from the ground up? And what is it like when you do? Like with Marco's perspective, he did get to write this thing from the ground up, but that means it's a weird thing that only he knows and that he didn't document that he's not interested in anymore, but it still exists and it still runs. And anyway, that's what the episode is about. We hope you find it entertaining. As we said on this member special, the next one, the one for December, will probably not be tech related. We'll see what that ends up being.
Yep. And remember, atp.fm/join. You can join for as little as a month. You can join for a year. You can, you know, grab all the member specials, get your discount, and then cancel. And because we respect you, that's easy to do. But because you love us, you won't do that. You're going to join and say, holy smokes, this is the best decision I've ever made. Happy Christmas, Hanukkah, birthday, whatever to me. I'm just going to stick with it. And that's what we recommend. So atp.fm/join, atp.fm/store. Treat yourself. Now's the time. All right, let's do some follow-up. Todd Shireski writes, amen to Face ID on Macs. As someone who that uses his Mac completely hands-free, Face ID on the studio display and MacBooks would be a game changer. I am paralyzed from the shoulders down. Having Face ID in place when Apple's accessibility feature voice control came about was truly a life-changing moment. It gave me complete independence, being able to operate my phone and iPad by voice completely by myself. It would be nice to have the same independence with my MacBook and Macs connected to the studio display. You know, I've been telling myself I need to try to work on being more aware of the non-vanilla case for everything. That's oftentimes, you know, thinking about accessibility, but not exclusively. And this was just a complete oversight on my part. And I thought Todd made the point very succinctly. We should think about that. And that would be real. I mean, it would be nice for all of us, as with most accessibility things, but it would be doubly nice for those of us who have that kind of need. So,
and especially the studio display, because you don't have problems of like, oh, it's not thick enough. You know what I mean? Like, or like that's a place where I feel like you can solve these problems. And apparently they're not afraid to add hundreds of dollars for accessories like the stand. So I just throw a Face ID in there.
Yeah. Something tells me that they have the margin in that product to add the one additional sensor, because like they already have a camera, and you're right, they have room, you know, at the wazoo in that product. So Yeah, I'm pretty sure they could add, like, you know, the IR blaster thing, and like that would be fine. Especially like when you look at like how inexpensive the phones are now that have it in it. It's like, okay, like now almost every iPhone model, including almost every one of the less expensive ones, has Face ID now. And it's probably a very short matter of time before they all have them. Well, you know, once they do the next iPhone SE, that it might be all Face ID at that point. So, you know, they can. It's no longer a cost thing. And you know, you look at the studio display, and there's a few misses in that product. So maybe it just didn't make it in time or whatever. But hopefully, when they update their monitors, which they do very frequently, I'm sure it's just a small matter of time.
Once a generation, they update the monitors.
Someday.
We mean human generations, not hardware generations.
I don't even want to think about it. All right. Jamie West writes, oily noses are not just useful for testing for fingerprints.
Oh, God.
I can't find the original source now, but at some point in the past, BBC TV technicians used vision mixers, which had faders that would sometimes get a bit sticky, causing the crossfades to visibly not be smooth. As everything was basically still done live back then, you couldn't exactly stop to perform some quick maintenance. But often a quick rub on the side of the operator's nose and an application of nose grease to the fader would be enough to get it unstuck and moving smoothly again.
Ew.
So first of all, yuck. Second of all, that's actually kind of interesting.
This sounds a lot like something that a British person would make up to tell Americans to make them see how gullible they are.
Yeah,
how do
surely.
You get the grease? Yeah. How do you get the grease down into the part where the friction surfaces meet? Like, you could put grease on the top of it, but that doesn't help you anyway. I hope this isn't true.
All right. And then we have microwave follow up, because how could we not? This is the Accidental Appliance Podcast. Nate writes, the modern knob. That was the whole tweet or toot, I guess. And it's a photograph of a LG microwave. It has a display in the upper right hand corner. It has what appears to be a horizontal slider labeled time with a minus on one side, a plus on the other, and then stop start buttons. That's the whole microwave. That's the toot.
I saw this and I thought of like car controls, and I was thinking like that's like a touch slider. You know how they do those things like with, instead of having a volume knob in a car, they'll have like this little tiny region with some gloss black plastic where you swipe your finger to change the volume. It's like it's like it was a contest. You've seen these things. There's like a contest for like how make the worst kind of progress bar, I think, with a dialogue box. Have you seen those? Right.
Yep.
This is like that, but in real life, someone's like, how can we make the worst, most annoying interface to a microwave? And it's like, you know, how about just a knob? No, too simple. How about a minus button? And I really hope you can swipe between them, because that would just make it so much worse. This is terrible.
Yeah, it's so bad. And yet, I feel like for me, I found one worse. And Keith Bradnam writes, I love our microwave for its rejection of any complexity. Just four buttons, microwave, defrost, start, and stop/cancel. I'm not kidding, folks. We will put a link in the show notes to a photograph of this microwave. It's a display, God. Microwave, defrost, stop, start, and cancel.
And what is the microwave done? You think the microwave does like 30 seconds, right?
I don't know. But anyway, Keith continues, you repeatedly press the microwave or defrost buttons to set the cooking time. It has an LED display, but I love how it doesn't even bother to include a clock. And sure,
well, that's
enough,
a feature, not a bug. Like, well, not having a clock is great.
Yeah, honestly, that I wish fewer appliances would have clocks on them, because that's fewer things that you have to reset every time they get out of sync or daily saving time happens.
Yeah, or that's if they would just set themselves based on the weird AM radio thing, or I mean, everything has internet access now. But yeah, no, microwave interfaces are the opposite of what Twitter apps were. They're a UI playground for people to do terrible things.
I will say, though, the feedback suggests that knob-based microwaves are actually extremely common everywhere except the U.S.
Yeah, like, but did you see the European ones that they sent pictures of? They look a lot like the kitchen timer, like mechanical ticky-ticky one, and that's not really what you want. Like, I know that's also a knob, but it's like the kind of thing where you, to get it back to zero, you can like push it and it goes, and it's just, that's not great.
Yeah.
It is not great, that is for sure. All right, now we move into the scanning photos corner. Ryan writes, I'm the crazy one who decided to scan my family photos, crop them, and apply dates. I wrote a post on how I went about it, and we'll put a link in the show notes. It took a couple of years, but it's been incredible being able to go back and find photos by dates, get face detection photos, etc. Then friend of the show, Todd Vaziri, writes, one of our pandemic projects was to do something about the thousands of prints and film negatives that we had in shoeboxes in our basement and finally get them digitized. We ultimately used a service called Scan Cafe and were extremely happy with the results. The print scans were far better than anything we could have accomplished at home, and the negative scans were spectacular. However, one thing to keep in mind before anyone embarks on a project like this is to plan and organize before you ship off your prints and negatives, and be prepared for tons of work after you get the scans. Create logical batches of prints and negatives in chronological order as best you can, because the service will honor your naming conventions. Once you get your scans, you could simply import them all into Apple Photos and be done. But taking that extra step of assigning them dates at a minimum and at maximum with geotags and captions will take hours and hours and hours of work. Be prepared. And all in all, we organized scan categories and dated over 3,500 photos that span over 3 decades. And I'm so glad we took the time to do so, because now we have an incredible organized digital photo library that are backed up in triplicate, and we never have to worry about losing our physical prints or negatives ever again.
Yeah, I forgot to mention this with my scanning thing, although it doesn't take, depending on how much work you put in, it doesn't take that much time, certainly not as much time as scanning with my stupid slow scanner. But the problem that you will encounter is, when was this taken? If you're lucky, you have that obnoxious burned in like little 7-segment display date on the picture, right? And if you're extra lucky, that date is right, because speaking of setting your clocks on things, not everyone was good about setting the clocks on their instant cameras or whatever, or not instant cameras, but their film cameras. So very often that date can be wrong. But the older the pictures get, like before the advent of that kind of date stamping, like in my childhood, those things didn't really exist. Like, what year was this? How old do I look here? Am I 7? Am I 8? Mm-hmm. Am I 4? Like, if you're lucky, you can see, okay, this is when we lived in that house in this town. And then you get into stuff from like my parents' childhood. They don't know when it is. I'm going to tell my parents, when was this taken? They're like, I don't know, sometime in this decade range. Oh, it's brutal. Like, and the sooner you do it, like the more relatives you have who are alive, who could perhaps date them. Like, I have super old pictures that I got from like my uncle scanned a lot of stuff from his father. Right. So they're super old black and white pictures. And I'm lucky if I can get a decade. I do surveys with relatives like, which decade do we think this is? 40s or 50s? Forget about geotagging with location. And they're like, oh, by the way, who's in this picture? There's Uncle Bob. I have no idea who these two people are. Does anybody know? It gets harder the longer you wait. And even for your own pictures, like I can tell we were in college, but what year were we in college, right? It's really difficult to do. And so what you kind of have to do, and I really, really wish Photos had this feature, although it's not on my very long list of things that I want them to add immediately, but the concept in Boolean logic of don't cares, right? Where I want to be able to put in a date and I can say, look, all I got is the year. This is 1962. I got nothing else, right? But you can't do that in Photos.
Yeah, you
got
to make like a month and a day.
Right. And so you have to come up with a convention where I just do January 1st at like 12 a.m. But what if something legitimately happened on January 1st? Like, it's
like, wow, we take a lot of pictures when we're hungover after New Year's.
Right.
Yeah. Or like,
and it's summertime.
Yeah. And then you'll find one. Then you'll find one that you have a date for, but now it's all messed up because you know that one came between these ones, but you shove them all up into January. And even though you don't know the months for those, you know this one was somewhere in the middle of them. It's very difficult. Like, even if you just know it's the 60s, you can't put, like, if you put 1960, how, later you're going to remember that, oh, that wasn't really 1960. I just put 1960 because I didn't know which year in the 60s it was. So photo apps aren't good at that. So do the best you can. That's why photo albums where someone wrote in, like, you know, grandmotherly cursive right next to them with dates and stuff, that is a godsend. But yeah, do the best you can and realize that that is going to be, even if you get them scanned, that's going to be the majority of your work, especially if you're not organized, like Todd says, when you send them off, because they'll send them back to you. And sometimes there is no discernible order. And sometimes the order is just whatever you sent them in. And who knows if that order is right. So yeah, it's a big job. And the longer you wait, the harder it gets.
Indeed. Nathaniel Velez writes, on the topic of things Apple still needs to improve on its laptops, at the top of my list is the durability of the plastic used for the keyboards. They become shiny with just a few days of use because of your fingertips being able to sand and polish the plastic. I always thought that was unavoidable since it happens with most cheap keyboards, but since getting a slightly fancier mechanical keyboard that doesn't have this issue, I learned that if Apple used different materials, we would not have to live with laptop keyboards that look disgusting. I'm always curious why people don't complain about this more. I was happy to see at least one review from CNET mentioned the shiny, disgusting keyboard problem. Man, I am mealy-mouthed today. Anyways, we have a link in the show notes. I definitely notice that my finger grease gets on the keyboard, and I don't ever feel like I've worn a keyboard down to the point that it's, you know, the paint on it is being lost. Maybe it's because, although I do not change keyboards and computers like Marco changes his keyboards and computers, which is like most changes.
He never
changes
the keyboard. It's the same one, just keeps rotating.
That's true.
Well, yes. I have many copies of the same one, which appears to now be finally fully for real discontinued.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
they're all gone from Amazon.
Yeah, me with my cheese graters and you with your keyboards. We're just running through the back catalog now.
Yeah. Good grief. At some point in the next 15 years, I might run out of them and have to switch keyboards.
Yeah, same with my cheese graters.
Anyways, so I find that, the finger grease thing is a thing. For me, every month or so, and there's no real, schedule to it, it's just when I notice my keyboard is getting gross, I'll take one of the Mr. Clean magic erasers. I think there is a that's the zero. What is it? Proprietary eponym, the Xerox.
Yes. What you're looking for is melamine foam. That's the actual thing. It's like a
some of those are also infused with some gunk,
some of them are infused with.
Yeah, and you really don't want to put that in your computer.
Yeah, if you're buying a magic eraser, make sure it's like the plain, like
unscented,
unflavored,
no bleach.
Yeah. Because one time I accidentally bought a little box of like the ones that use them, and they like foam up with soapy something.
Yeah,
and it's like, oh, this is totally wrong.
And I don't know if I would even want that grit to go there. I know we don't have butterfly keyboards anymore, but that stuff does kind of like flake a little bit when you're using it. But anyway, Casey, why are you taking a magic eraser? What are you trying to remove? Like,
so the paint. Yeah, no, to get the keyboard or the finger grease off the keyboard. And I've been doing this for years and years across.
Why do you need abrasive to do that?
You don't need abrasive. It's just it works well. I don't know. It's just what I've found that works the best. I'm sure that's not the only way to do it. Maybe even just a damp cloth would be enough. But that's what I've always used, and it's worked well for me.
Yeah, I would suggest you maybe not do that and instead use the very slightest of dampness on a thing, because you just want to like carry away. Finger grease will come off pretty easily. You just got to get a cleanish thing there to anyway. Doing the keyboard. This annoys me. We've talked about this before. It annoys me that iPads, I guess it's annoying too, but especially Macs are so not waterproof like the phones are. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And for reasons that make sense, like there are reasons, but maybe we'll get this if we actually get to this topic. Boy, it would be great if they did that better, because it makes cleaning your keyboard on your MacBook, and your MacBook especially, so fraught. If you're like, oh, I have a vaguely damp cloth and I'm just going to use this to do the keys, and you wad it up a little bit and you press it and the little droplet of water comes out and it slips between the key and the thing. You're like, no, like you do not want water to go inside that thing at all. Now, you can clean it when it's down and it's annoying. You got to buy those apps that disable the keyboard so the thing doesn't turn back on, and it's too fraught, right? But on the topic, on Nathaniel's question about like, why don't people complain about the keyboards being gross? I think we've talked about this before. Some people have fingers that excrete something that destroys keyboards. And it is not a personal failing. It does not show that they are haunted by demons. It is just a thing. There is no value judgment here, but it's a thing that happens. We all know people, if you've, you know, worked in offices or whatever, you know, they'll have like a standard issue keyboard for the whole company, or everyone will have MacBook Pros, and one person will wear the letters off their keys within 2 weeks. Another person will use a keyboard for 7 years and be typing madly on it all the time, and it will be fine. Setting aside finger grease, which is an aesthetic thing of like how greasy does it look, it's a separate issue. I'm saying the people who have like, I don't actually know what it is. Is it acidic? Is it they have calluses on their hands? I don't know what it is, but something about their hands just, it really wears down the keycaps. In terms of using different materials, I think matte versus glossy makes a difference, kind of like it does for the fingerprint showing up on like the glossy mirrored Apple logo on the back of the new laptops versus the anodized matte bumpy thing or whatever. So that is a factor. So part of that is the Johnny Ive hangover of like, boy, the keyboards look nice when no one has ever touched them and they're glossy black, right? But then, of course, you touch it, right? Same thing with piano black interiors on cars, which they're still making in this year. They're still making them. Please stop, people. It scratches so easily.
Do you remember how bad that was in the M5, Marco? It was awful.
Yeah, the piano black. Oh, God.
They still, do you believe they still do that? Like every car review for the past 5 years, has some section where they said, oh, and they use piano black on the interior, and they roll their eyes and with a knowing look to the audience. This is, of course, we all know this is a bad idea, but the car makers don't think it's a bad idea, probably because it looks good in the showroom and they don't care what it looks like after they sell it to you. Anyway.
It does look really nice.
Yes, until you touch it or any dust goes near it.
Yeah, it's very similar to the jet black iPhone 7 finish. Like, yeah, it scratches instantly, but even with some scratches on it, it still looks really nice.
But the dust shows up on it a lot, like especially in a car interior. Yeah. If you ever carry pets or anything, or if you ever use a tissue and blow your nose, and the tissue dust like goes out of the, it's not a good idea. So yeah, I think Apple could make a keyboard appearance that is more resilient to fingers touching it, kind of in the same way that they have with the anodized coating on the new black ones. Like, just, you know, we're not saying it's perfect, but try to improve on that. Obviously, in some areas, it's going to be difficult, like trackpad, which you touch a lot. And, you know, iPhones and iPads, they're touch screens. We're constantly touching the screens. If you really ever look at an iPhone or an iPad screen, especially when it's off, they're covered with grease. But that's why Apple has the oleophobic coating and they work on that, right? It's an area that Apple should continue to advance on. I feel like on the keyboards, I don't know if they're better or worse. We should get someone to write in and say, I am a person whose fingers wear the things on the keycaps. And by the way, I think they're not painted on there. That's part of the thing. We need Mike Hurley on the show to tell us all about the keyboard technology of like, you know, dyeing in, putting in different colors of plastic and molding them together. There's all these techniques.
Well, they're backlit, probably not painted, I would assume. I'm the one who said painted.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They're not painted. There are various techniques where you're not actually touching the letter part, so you shouldn't really ever wear it off. But for laptop keys, it may be more difficult because they're so thin. Anyway, I agree. This is an area that Apple should improve. But I think in general, they don't look that gross to me when I see people's laptops in real life. And I think the problem of some people destroying keyboards with their fingers is, it's not unsolvable, but it's going to be more difficult, especially since I personally don't understand what is the difference, but there is a difference there. You can categorize people into my fingers destroy keyboards and my fingers just wear them in the normal amount. And I hesitate to say normal because it sounds, you know, anyway, but like there is a difference. And yeah, that's exactly, it is like, I don't know what the difference is. It could be as simple as calluses. It could be different pH level to the secretions from their fingertips. And like, it is what it is. Apple should design products to withstand the use that they expect. And, you know, they could do better on the keyboards, but I think Apple's keyboards, now that they've gotten rid of the butterfly thing, are not below average for the industry. And I personally don't think they look too disgusting, even when they're kind of greasy.
All right, moving along. We got some feedback from Gokhan Avkarug.
We're gonna put him in. This is a big wig guy at Apple on the GPU team, and now I've said his name a few times in the thing. He's gonna be in the show notes until we get his last name right. We're just gonna keep doing it until we get it right.
Give me another pass. Hold on, this is the magic of editing. All right. We got some feedback from Gokhan Avkarugulari, who writes, if you're curious about what the new A17 Pro and M3 GPU and dynamic caching is all about, and the brand new and exceptional GPU dev tooling and shader best practices, Apple has released a bunch of new tech talks today as this was written. And one in particular, 111375, I'll put a link in the show notes, is all about the new GPUs, which, what did they call them in the video? It was like Apple GPU 6 or something like that. I forget exactly.
Yeah, like it has a generation number or something.
Yeah, it was very surprising for me as someone who doesn't ever pay attention to GPUs, to be completely honest with you. But they did talk about and explain in a much better way, which I'm not going to try to recount, what this dynamic caching is all about, why it matters, and why it's helpful. And even as someone who knows almost nothing about GPUs, I was able to grok it, and it was fascinating. And the whole video is like half an hour, so it's worth watching.
Apple Family 9 GPUs is what they're called.
There you go.
Family 9. And yeah, so this is, what we said last week was accurate, that the dynamic caching is about cache of local memory on the GPU. Obviously, the video goes into it in more detail. The takeaway I got from the video is that doing this dynamic caching thing is not just about making more efficient use of resources, or rather that's not the only point. It's like, okay, I can see maybe you save power, or like, you know, it's, you can have a smaller GPU again, which saves you power, but you can do the same job with it. But there's actually, I mean, this makes sense, but there's a performance story to it as well. They talk about it in the video. One of the things they're always trying to optimize in GPUs is what Apple and I think the rest of the industry calls thread occupancy, which is how many things are in flight inside the GPU at the same time, how many things that it's doing. And if you make inefficient use of these local caches, if one of them comes in and says, I need to reserve, you know, a 10 by 100 block of data here, and I'm only going to use the 10 thing once, and the rest of the time I'm just using ones, but I need to reserve the whole block just for that one 10 in there, then there's not enough room for another job to come in because, like, sorry, that shared resource that you wanted a chunk of, there's not enough left for you. So you got to wait until I'm done. Having more better thread occupancy means you could have more of those threads in the GPU at the same time, which means, in gamer speak, better frame rates, because something that needs to run on the GPU isn't waiting, going, I got to wait for these other jobs. One of these other jobs needs to finish before I can get on the GPU and do my thing. So it is actually a performance story there. And so that's good to see, and is relevant to pretty much anything that a GPU does. It's also relevant to laptops for, like, you know, getting your job done faster so you can power down the GPU and not be using it or whatever. And you can do more work with less power because, you know, the GPU is not running as long, but it should also help give you better frame rates. So thumbs up.
Jonathan Reagan Kelly writes, and this, I think, was born from that video we just mentioned, an interesting detail. Apple not only avoids statically allocating space for threads, they also unify the memory for different types of state within the shader core and dynamically allocate space among them. They are also pooled with tile cache and other cache in buffer memory. Many GPUs do have unified memory for a quote-unquote thread group, scratch pad memory, and L1 cache, but only allow the allocation between these two roles to be configured statically per kernel. While it may seem surprising to unify quote-unquote registers and quote-unquote caches, it's important to know that the GPU register storage is so large, up to 32 megs on a recent NVIDIA GPU, that it is generally built from SRAM, not literal register file circuits, so it really is the same kind of thing as all the other caches and scratch pads or buffers. As someone who has worked on and around GPU architectures for a long time, this is indeed a promising idea. The devil's in the details. What is the cost of the complexity this adds to the hardware? How good are the dynamic allocation algorithms in practice? How bad are the penalties when some state isn't cached? But this is cool to see and is actually a big change from how most other modern GPUs work, which could provide real efficiency wins.
This is actually a good pairing with Apple's unified memory architecture, and it's of the same category of, I always use this analogy, which may resonate with some of our listeners, but hopefully you can understand it, of back in the bad old days of Linux, when you would install Linux, it would ask you to sort of partition your drive to say, how much do you want to dedicate to the slash partition? How much to this user partition? And you'd have to sort of say, okay, well, the operating system is this big, and I'll need a little bit of extra room in case I want to install stuff in slash, but most of the stuff is going to be in user, including the user home directories and anything that's in user local. So how big do I want that to be? And how big do I want to do for a swap partition based on how much memory I have? And you have to make all these decisions kind of upfront of, like, deciding how big these buckets will be. And the consequences of picking one wrong are annoying. So, like, oh, I got to repartition, or maybe I have to erase the entire disk. And of course, with a GPU or a CPU, if you're going to have multiple buckets of stuff and you have to pick ahead of time how big those buckets are going to be, you don't want to make the buckets too small because that can be a performance bottleneck. And everyone says, oh, they made the whatever bucket too small in the CPU. It really hurts performance. But if you make them too big, you're wasting power and transistors and die space. on resources that aren't going to use, and that stuff could have been used elsewhere on the chip where it would have been useful. So it's hard to pick those things. And same thing with, like, you know, VRAM and regular RAM, and having to have like a big pool of VRAM and a big pool of regular RAM and transfer between them, and how big are the pools. Unified memory solves that in Apple's architecture because it's just one big pool of hopefully very fast memory. And on the GPU, same deal. Why have three different buckets of memory needed by the GPU? Because in any given, you know, job that the GPU is running, it may need a lot from bucket one, a little bit from bucket two, and nothing from bucket three. And if you get a whole bunch of jobs that are like that, bucket one's going to fill up and bucket two and three are going to waste. Whereas if you have a unified pool, if you say, I don't make you pick ahead of time, you know, when you design your chip, how big these buckets are, there's just one big bucket. And the reason it works is because, as Jonathan points out, the registers aren't like CPU registers, how you learn about them in a CPU class, or, x86, you got AX, BX, CX, like these little registers that are the size of an int or whatever, that are super fast, and they're right there in the CPU. They're not like that in GPUs. It's all made of SRAM, which is what, like, the L1, L2 caches are. And it's big. There's like 32 megabytes of it. So Apple making one big pool of that definitely fits with their unified memory architecture and totally makes sense. And it seems like their implementation is pretty good. I mean, granted, this is their first run at it, but after 3 weeks of looking at dynamic caching, I give it a thumbs up.
All right, M3 SSD speed versus M3 Pro SSD speed. John, can you take us through this, please?
Yeah, last week we were saying, hey, in previous generations, Apple would sometimes ship the base model with half the number of SSD, you know, packages on the logic board that would cause the SSD to be half the speed. And it's like, oh, if you got the 256 gigabyte, it's half the speed. And then if you got the 512, which is a shame. And then with this generation, they didn't do that. Like, we looked at the M3 ones, and even if you get the base model M3, granted the base model M3 MacBook Pro has 512, but either way, if you get the base model, it doesn't have half the number of chips. And so we did speed tests on it, and lo and behold, it's twice as fast as the bad old base model M2 was, as the 256 was, right? But then we compared it to a 1 terabyte thing, and it's like, but the 1 terabyte is twice as fast again. So what's going on here? And the thing we didn't notice last week is, the 1 terabyte one was an M3 Pro. It wasn't just a plain old M3 with 1 terabyte. It was an M3 Pro with 1 terabyte. So kind of like with the RAM situation of, like, what's the deal with these RAM sizes? How do they make any sense? They make sense in terms of how many chips there are. So the M3 SoC supports a maximum of 2 NAND packages, 2 little flash memory rectangular things on the logic board. The M3 Pro supports a maximum of 4 NAND packages. And if you look at an M3 Pro teardown, you might not see it, but there's like 2 on top of the logic board and then 2 underneath on the underside. So you won't see another 2 like things on the, if you're just looking at one side of it, the other 2 on the other side. And then the M3 Max supports a maximum of 8 NAND packages. Doesn't mean they're all filled in. Like, if you get the M3 Max one and you get a smaller SSD, I don't know what the size threshold is, but if you get a smaller one, all 8 spots on the logic board won't be filled. Maybe only 4 of them will be. But the upshot of all of this is that every NAND package you add adds more maximum bandwidth in these artificial benchmarks. Because, you know, if you're writing to it, you can be writing to all of them at once, right? And so that's why you get twice the speed if you have 2 chips, because now you're writing to them, both of them once. You know, they're both the same speed as the one was, but now you get double. And if you double it again to 4 NAND packages, then you can double it again. And that is borne out by Marco's monster M3 Max MacBook Pro with an 8 terabyte SSD, which has all 8 of the NAND packages filled in. And by the way, each NAND package has an Apple custom controller die plus 4 to, I think, 16 NAND dies all inside that little package. That's what's in those little rectangles in the thing. So, and when Marco did a brief speed test with that Blackmagic speed test app that everybody uses, he was getting 8,200 megabytes per second in write speed and 5,600 megabytes per second in read speed. So finally, if you pay whatever ungodly sum Apple charges for this 8 terabyte SSD, you too can have a faster SSD than the $75 1 terabyte stick that's in my PS5, which, by the way, is 5,500 megabytes per second read and write.
Oh my God.
Kind of depressing, but anyway, this is why we get this doubling. Why was the M3 Pro twice as fast as the M3? Because it has 4 NAND packages, and the M3 only supports 2, and the M3 Max supports 8. Who knows how many the Ultra will support? Probably only 8, but we'll see if and when that comes out.
Anonymous writes, The single package, quote unquote, bad SSD configuration was debated a lot, and it was ultimately decided it was the right trade-off. The performance analysis team, which is not the performance marketing team, this one is part of engineering, determined that there was a point of sharply diminishing returns in SSD performance in real-world workloads versus benchmarks. They were surprised at first, too, and the SSD and NAND teams were skeptical. So there was a lot of discussion about this, but outside of the file copy to or from a fast or Thunderbolt external SSD, they just didn't see significant impact in real-world workflows. So all of us were getting our junk in a wad for no good reason.
Well, not anyway, this is an explanation of the bad ones on the M2, right? So why did Apple do that with the M2 ones? There was internal debate about it, and this is what they came up with. Like, okay, well, yes, it's half speed when you run a benchmark, but like, who's running benchmarks? Like, where does it impact real thing? And so the little part here at the end here is, outside of file copy to from a fast external SSD, I think when people are waiting on disk IO, it's probably because they're doing a big copy. So that's a pretty big exception to say, oh, it doesn't affect real world scenarios, except for when you're really waiting for a gigantic copy. Now, obviously, copies to itself on the internal drive don't count because APFS has those constant time, you know, instant clone, copy and write magic things or whatever. But if you're trying to pull something from a very fast SSD that's connected with Thunderbolt or copy something to one, that's when you're going to hit this bottleneck. So the bottleneck was there, but if you're doing pretty much anything other than that, what this anonymous source from Inside Apple is saying is, in our testing, if you're doing like a real world task that is not a big file copy to an external drive, you know, again, if you the diminishing returns, right? And I still think it wasn't a good choice. And whether Apple revisited that decision, which is why we don't have the problem on the M3, or whether we don't have the problem with M3 merely because they bumped the base config to 512. Either way, the problem doesn't exist anymore, so it's kind of a moot point. But this just goes to show, when Apple does something like this, they do debate it internally. They may not come to the decision that we on the outside agree with, but they always do have their reasons.
Indeed. Let's talk about SSD prices. CG writes, I thought of this graph when Marco was talking about how cheap SSDs have gotten. If this trend continues, I'm hoping to go all SSD on my NAS in a few years. So this is from the Reddit community Data Hoarder. And they show a graph of SSD prices as compared to regular spinning platter hard disks. And back in the ye olden times of 2013, a spinning platter hard drive was about $36 a terabyte, and a SSD was $625 a terabyte. However, here in 2023, we're down to, according to this chart, about $35 a terabyte for an SSD and $13 a terabyte for platters. And if you chart these lines out, somewhere around 2030-ish, SSDs could feasibly be even cheaper than spinning platters. I'll believe it when I see it, but if you follow the trend line, that's what the graph would indicate. And that's fascinating, and certainly does not match what Apple is charging people like Marco for their SSD size increases.
The SSD line is pretty steep. Like, we'll put a link in the notes. You can look at what the graph is. The reason they're going to meet is because the SSD line is going down faster than the hard drive line. And I'm amazed at how linear both of them are. They're very well. I guess this is a logarithmic graph. I think it is. But anyway, having them across in 2030. Tune in 2030 to see if that has actually happened. But boy, won't that be a glorious moment!
I mean, even just the ratio between them, like, you know, back 10 years ago, the SSD was almost 20 times more expensive per byte than the hard drive. Now it's like 3 times. Like, it's still a large multiple, and if you're looking at a huge amount of storage, but if you're, you know, there's also a huge number of advantages for SSDs, and so that actually might, now that it's, you know, quote, only 3 times the price per gig or whatever, that makes it a lot more compelling in a lot more situations. So this is great news. As long as you're buying anybody except Apple's SSDs, everyone else's SSDs in the market are getting remarkably affordable.
Indeed. David Schaub writes, it's hard to believe that consumer Mac laptops have had the same base RAM since 2017, and the base RAM has only increased one time since 2011. So in the last 12 years, we've gotten one bump. And there is a logarithmic chart that we will put in the show notes that displays this. It's sad times, y'all. Not good times.
Yeah, if you look at this graph, like, the kind of the point of this graph is like, the graph kind of divided it down the middle, the left half and the right half of the graph. And the left half of the graph seems like we had pretty regular bumps. The slope looks pretty good. It's going up, up, up. And then in the right half of the graph, it's like a knee in the curve, and it just levels off, and it becomes like asymptotically approaching 8 gigs or 8.1 gigs or whatever. And David Chomp continues with the future one where he color codes the graph. He says, I don't think it's quite this simple, but the graph has the left side colored in with green. It says Steve Jobs because it goes from 1999 to 2011 when Jobs died. And then the right side is Tim Cook. And in the Tim Cook era, there has been one bump in base RAM on consumer laptops. And the Steve Jobs era, of the same length of time, there were 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, it doesn't mean that, does that mean that Tim Cook, unlike Steve Jobs, keeps products around longer? We know he does that, right? But there are other things that may be factors here. Maybe it is the case that this is just a natural curve of RAM prices in general, and they just, you know, the graph of RAM prices also takes a curve like this. I think that's really true. Someone sent us a thing of RAM prices, but one thing about the RAM price chart is it is not as smooth as the SSD and hard drive chart that we had previously. There is actually a lot of volatility in RAM prices. And as the person who sent us the chart pointed out, Apple doesn't sort of buy the RAM prices at instant in time. They have to sort of lock in a order of however huge quantity at whatever the price is at that time, which is sometimes advantageous to Apple. Hey, we just ordered, you know, 10 billion sticks of this kind of RAM back when there were sticks. At this price. And that's great because now it's gone up since then. But sometimes they lock in the price at a higher price and that's bad for them. But either way, what this graph shows, it doesn't really allow you to assign blame or say someone was doing something wrong or whatever. But it does show you that the feeling you have that RAM has not been going up as quickly in the past decade or so, that is a real feeling when it comes to Apple consumer laptop based RAM. Hopefully we'll get that next bump soon. And by the way, the one bump that we had since 2011 was from 4 to 8. So I would love for the next bump to be from 8 to 16, but we'll see how that goes.
So let's talk about Mac laptops. Marco, you and I both have received some new treats, and I feel like we should talk about them. So Marco, tell me what you got. And I don't know if you want to round robin it, if you just want to start talking and I'll interrupt when necessary, but tell me about what you bought.
I got the big one. It's awesome. I'm so happy with it.
Good talk.
I did get the black, as mentioned last episode when I had it sitting next to me on my desk, but I had not yet actually moved into it yet. It is great. I've been doing a lot of overcast work the last couple of days, a lot of having to do clean builds to work around bugs in Xcode. So I've been doing a lot of clean builds during regular development that wouldn't be necessary in the Objective-C days, but they're certainly necessary now. My computer is now much faster at doing those clean builds. I measured it. A clean build of Overcast went from about 19 seconds to about 11 seconds. So it's almost twice as fast at doing this surprisingly common and increasingly common task that makes me stop and wait. So that's a pretty big gain for me. I'm very happy for that. As mentioned, I also, I wanted to upgrade for a few other reasons. I wanted some more capacity. I wanted, I wanted a little bit more RAM and I had a good use in mind for a friend who really could use the outgoing laptop. So it was a solid upgrade for me. Like the build time reduction alone would make this worthwhile to me at this point in my development life. Because again, just how many times per day I'm having to do not only incremental builds but especially clean builds, which are so time consuming. As I push more and more of my code base into Swift and Swift UI, it just increases how much of that how much stress is being put on the development process. Because for those of you who don't know, like Swift and Swift UI are extremely complex languages at the compile side, and part of the reason why is that they are doing huge amounts of complexity at compilation time to save you from yourself, basically, to save you from different classes of bugs, to enforce different features and protections within the Swift type system, and the Swift language itself is also extremely complicated. And of course, Swift UI really pushes everything to the limits with the way it abuses the language to achieve what it achieves. Even if you're not using previews, which I actually am not using Swift UI Live previews that much in my work so far. And if you do use SwiftUI previews, it pushes it even harder. Whereas, if I compile Objective-C code today, it builds in, a half a second, and it's just done. and you know, if I make a mistake in Objective-C code, like it highlights it instantly. Like it's so fast because Objective-C and C that it's based on are just much smaller and simpler languages to compile on modern hardware. But as I'm pushing my code base into the more modern languages, it is costing me dearly in computing resources at development time. Of course, that in the long run should prove worthwhile in the sense that not only does it, you know, get my code into where it needs to be for the future, but also it should prevent and avoid a lot of bugs along the way that cost developer time, which is much more precious than computing time. But anyway, all this is to say, the more Swift and Swift UI I'm using and moving towards, the greater my computing needs are, and the slower it is to build the app if I don't keep doing these upgrades every few years. So that's the biggest justification I have for the upgrade. And that, again, that alone, cutting the build time effectively almost in half after only 2 years. Like, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, oh, the M3 is only a little bit faster than the M2, which is actually not always the case. We'll get to that, but
not always the case. Never the case. Yeah, I've seen that same sentiment. And I do not understand it, which is why I put these graphs. We'll put a link in the show notes to a video that you should watch. But like when I was talking before about, oh, why should they compare it to the M2? Because you want to know if, like, is this the year to buy? The thing that got Marco excited to buy this when he was not excited about the M2 is, I mean, he just talked about it. The main thing he does all day that he waits for is now twice as fast. Like, if that's not enough, you know, forget about synthetic benchmarks or whatever. That's like him doing real world stuff. But if you care to look at the synthetic benchmarks, this Max Tech video has a whole bunch of them. Single core, you'll see the M3 line, the M2 line is barely past the M1 line. The M3 line is significantly past. Multi-core, the M3 is like double the M2 max. The M3 max is like double the M2 max. It's not even close. Like M1 to M2. Tiny little increase. M3, twice as fast, right? And the Cinebench score, same thing. In the logic test, it's like three times as fast as the M2 Max. In the logic test, it's faster than the M1 Ultra, right? This is, if you're wondering, is this the one to buy? Is this a good year? Yeah, the M3 is a good, if you're buying the highest of the high end, like Marco is, the M3 is a good year to buy. So I think Marco was very wise, and Casey, very wise to skip the M2. Not because the M2 was bad. The M2 was great. It was the best that you could get. But if you already have an M1, an M2 is a smaller upgrade. The M3, depending on what you're doing, could be a monstrous upgrade. The M3 Max, by the way, I'm talking about. Yeah. Not just the plain M3 of the Pro.
And this, I mean, we take this for granted now because the Apple Silicon era is just so incredibly good. Like, it's so bountiful with upgrades for us that seem to have basically no downsides except SSD costs. It wasn't that long ago that, you know, back in the tail end of the Intel days, not even just the tail end, like the whole rear third of the Intel days, getting almost 50% improvement gain in 2 years or whatever it's been, 2-3 years. It's only been two, right? Like that doesn't happen anymore. Like that hasn't happened in the PC chip world in a long time. 50% in 2.5 or 2 years, that's nuts. We would usually, for most of the last decade or more, we'd be lucky to get maybe 15% of a gain over that same time span in like sheer CPU performance during that time. Like, again, 15% between generations, maybe. And even then, it was usually achieved only with like some real thermal aggression.
and to be clear, on the for the single core, that's kind of what the M3 Max gets. So it's like 70% faster in single core than the M2 Max. But again, if you look at the difference between the M1 and the M2 Max, it was not 15%. So 17% single core for, you know, over a computer that came out in January and now we're getting into November is still pretty good. But the big wins come from like, okay, but what about the multi-core and to a lesser extent, some of the GPU stuff, right? And that's what, like, you know, you might think of like, oh, a compiler, isn't that a single core thing? No, there's plenty of things to be compiled. And so you can use those cores because each core is compiling a different file and many files make up an application, in case that's not clear if you're not a software developer. That's why, you know, Marco is not getting 15% faster compiles because it is a multi-core type of thing. And we do pay a price for it, like the prices of the M3 Max can use at peak, like, 50 watts-ish, and the M2 Max was using maybe 35-37 watts. There's a little bit more you know, power being used, a little bit more heat being generated, but nothing that I think the cooling system can't handle.
Yeah, that is one area that it's a little too soon to say. I mean, I've never heard the fan so far in the week that I've had this. It's a little too soon to say whether that will be a noticeable difference here, because I noticed the same thing. I believe it was an Antec who had like the power consumption graphs of the various Max chips over time, and they are ramping up the power usage at peak. And that is, I got to say, I was not happy to see that in those graphs because I'm a little worried now.
You can't get blood from a stone. Like, if you want it to be faster and you want to have more of a performance core, is doing all that extra work, they have to use more power. But, like, we're not sure about the efficiency, but that was the point that was made by someone whose name I forget in a past episode, was that the M2, despite using more heat than the M1, was still more efficient because it would be done with the same amount of work faster. And I would imagine that's also true of the M3 Max.
I hope so, and probably, But certainly, it remains to be seen. Like, you know, the M1 Max was so glorious because that computer just never spun the fan up. And I still am so proud of the M1 Max MacBook Pro and so baffled by the M1 Max Mac Studio, because like the Mac Studio was frankly embarrassed by the MacBook Pro. That it had that first gen Mac Studio had that weird thermal design where the fan was audible at all times, whereas the MacBook Pro had the same processor as the base Mac Studio and was never audible.
the problem with the Mac Studio was that even at max load, the fans were the same speed as when it was idle, and they were like the cooling system was so over provisioned. But then it never got quiet enough for my taste anyway, right? So you'd run a benchmark and it'd be like, how fast are the fans going compared to when it was idle? Oh, same speed. Like they didn't need to go any faster, but it was still annoying. But anyway, they fixed that in the M2 Mac Studio generation. So yeah, if you're worried about a Mac Studio, I'm assuming that also won't be, that it'll be fine in the M3 generation as well.
Yeah, I would assume so as well. But anyway, I mean, I'm extremely happy with this so far. Even the black is nice. I've had it now in more varied lighting conditions, and all the YouTubers, they're still complaining like, well, it's not that dark. Honestly, it's pretty dark. Like, maybe if you are in a video studio with spotlights pointing at it, maybe it's not that dark. I mean, I live in a pretty bright place. Like, I'm in a lot of sunlight or sunny rooms these days, and it's pretty dark. I'm very happy with it. I don't think I will go black for all my computers in the future, but I like this one being black as just like a different, fresh, new take on things. And yeah, I was working on it earlier today, like in laptop mode, on a couch, in the sun, using the built-in speakers to play Fish, which are surprisingly decent. Like, it was great. I was getting a lot of work done. Once again, I am very, very glad that I got the 16-inch just because I need as much screen space as possible. Also, based partially on my need for screen space, but also on my preference for low noise, it does. I'm a little concerned about fan noise on the 14-inch models. If you spec them up with the M1 Max chip, that's a lot of thermal load. Because again, keep in mind they've increased the thermal caps on these chips, like of how much power they use at peak. They've increased that from the M1 generation through the M2 and the M3 now. So if you're worried about fan noise, I might advise you to either not get one of the big CPUs or not get the 14-inch, because I think the 16 can save you there a little bit. But also, the 16-inch has a much bigger battery, and so that's also nice if you're ever working on battery for a long time. But at the end of the day, no matter what the trade-offs were, I'd get the 16-inch for the screen size alone. It's a big, beautiful, awesome screen. So
I need to defend people who like laptops that are not aircraft carriers. I have.
They're not that different in size.
It's a difference. It's not like the 17 was back in the day. That thing was a monster, but it's different.
That thing was awesome.
It's close. I mean, 16-inch, like it's, what happened to the 15?
Yeah, well, the 17 had a lot more bezel to get, around that 17.
In any case, I
weighed almost twice as much.
Those things were seriously such beasts. I bought a 14-inch M3 Max. I stuck
so the
with
computer
the same...
I just told everyone not to buy.
Yeah, that's correct. I bought it with 64 gigs of RAM because I just didn't feel like I needed more than that. I'm sure it it wouldn't have hurt, but I decided to spend that money elsewhere. And specifically, I decided to spend it on their 8 terabyte SSD because I keep my entire photo library on my Mac, and that's something like 1.5 terabytes. And then you put in a few, you know, Xcodes and a few Xcode simulators or iOS simulators, what have you, and you start filling stuff up pretty quick. So that's what I got. And I got the Space Black because how could you not? And this thing is incredible. It just came in Monday afternoon, and I'd like to talk about in a moment how what I did with it once it got here in terms of loading it up. But putting that aside for a moment, I haven't had the time to do very much coding work since it came in because I recorded analog yesterday morning and didn't have a whole lot of time after that. And then I was prepping for ATP today, didn't have a whole lot of time after that. And so I haven't done a lot of coding work, but in general, this thing is just like a faster, peppier, even better version of what I already had. And I didn't have any complaints about what I already had. It was already really freaking great. And again, I came from an M1 Mac, 64 gigs, 4 terabytes. I love this computer. I have heard the fans. The only time I've heard the fans, would you like to guess what I was doing?
Running migration assistant?
Yeah, that was my
mind. I don't think I heard the fans then, and you're spoiling my moment here in a minute, but no, that's not what I was doing. What would I, Casey Liss, be doing that would cause the fans? There it is. I was doing a transcode in FFmpeg, and those fans got screaming. But, I mean, whatever. That's fine. I don't mind if the fans scream when I'm doing a transcode in FFmpeg. I forget exactly what I was doing, but I think I was taking something from H.264 to HEVC, you know, H.265, and I was doing it at something like 15 frames a second. No, what was it? It was 15x, not 15 frames a second, 15x. So 15 times normal speed. It was bananas how fast this was.
Was that using, I don't know what the options are. Who does know what the options are? Right. But anyway, were you using the ones that use the hardware encoders, or were you not using the ones that use the hardware encoders?
I understand the question. I actually don't know the answer. I was using Lisa Melton's scripts, if memory serves. And so I think those will try to use hardware encoders if possible. I am very not confident that I'm telling the truth.
I'm just wondering, because like if the fans spin up, like you think the fans wouldn't spin up if it's just using this tiny corner of the chip that is just the, you know, the fixed function H.265 encoder or whatever.
Yeah, I honestly, I understand the question. I don't know.
You should just look up at your menu bar. You have this eternal CPU usage bar. Does it say, hey, are a bunch of cores lit up, or is it just, you know, anyway. Yeah, in the benchmarking, like, you would see less of this back in when they were benchmarking the M1 Max and the M2 Max. But when they do the M2 Max versus M3 Max test, you can see that you can get the fans to spin up on both of them. They're just laptops, right? You know, they will spin their angry little fans and spew out hot air from their two little vents. But most people are not doing things that will torture your SoC like that. But if you do, be aware that you are going to hear those fans when you're using 50 watts.
Yeah, but otherwise, ignore Marco's propaganda. I was doing a little bit of Xcode remotely this morning. I went to my beloved Wegmans to do, you know, my ATP research. Then I had a little bit of time to do some Xcode work. No fans. Don't listen to his propaganda, people.
Well, I do. I haven't yet seen a good 14 versus 16, but for the M1 generation, 14 versus 16, the 16 did have better cooling capacity, which doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Like, because when you look at the teardowns, you're like, it looks like they have the same heat pipes, the same fans, the same, like, why should it make such a difference? Just because there's like a little bit more lateral room in the 16 inch, but it did in the M1 generation. So I haven't yet seen M3 test, but yeah, I don't actually know if the 14 inch is going to have appreciably worse or noisier cooler than the 16, but it's a possibility.
I mean, I'm guessing it's going to be worse, but not in a way that most people will typically run into.
And that's probably fair as well. I'd like to spend at least a minute talking about what I did when the computer came in. In years past, I've always done a fresh install. Unlike Windows, which last I used Windows, which admittedly was like 10 plus years ago, every 6 months, you needed to start from scratch. It's just the rule of Windows. Every 6 months, you start from scratch. You move everything somewhere else, you start anew. That's just the way it works. And I have not had that experience with the Mac. There have been some times where I feel like, you know, a reset in start anew has been necessary, but I can count those times on probably one hand, and I've been using a Mac for like 15 years now, something like that. I typically will do a fresh install. But this time I decided, you know what, I'm going to try Migration Assistant. And thankfully, I had my friend Marco here to run through the gauntlet of Migration Assistant first and instruct me on all the ways I need to save myself if things go wrong. That being said, I think the same thing that Marco did, and it pretty much just worked. So what I did was I used my cable is white and it's not braided, but I think
sometimes
the current
it just happens to you.
Yeah, sometimes it just happens. I used the it's an Apple cable, and I think it is a Thunderbolt 4 cable. I looked to put a link in the show notes just a moment ago, and I couldn't find it, but I found what I think is the new version, which is the Thunderbolt 4 Pro cable. This is a 1 meter long cable, so it's, you know, about a 3 foot long cable. That is $70. $70. It's bananas expensive. But that being said, when I was doing this migration, it took a while for it to admit to me slash itself that it was connected via Thunderbolt. You know, so I connected via Thunderbolt from one laptop to the other. And it really was not happy at first with doing that. And I wonder if, Marco, you might have bailed a little too soon on getting that process to work. I wish I should have taken better notes. It's not that I was rushing. I just didn't think to take copious notes as to what I was doing. But as you're going through Migration Assistant, which if you're not familiar, it's an Apple thing where you start basically kind of sort of a server on the old computer and you start a client on the new computer. That's probably not strictly accurate, but you get the idea. And it'll transfer all your stuff from one to the other. And when you're doing it on the target computer, on the new computer, it really, really wants you to sign on to Wi-Fi, or perhaps, you know, if you have an Ethernet connection, it really wants you to get on the internet via Wi-Fi or Ethernet. And I did neither. So I just kept saying, like, no, thank you. No, thank you. No, nope, not now. Not going to do it. Eventually, it finally relented. And then I saw that connection details screen that you can pull up where it says, OK, here's all the ways I can connect from the source to the target Mac. And sure enough, it says Casey's MacBook Pro or MacBook Pro is what I call the old one. Ethernet to Ethernet on this Mac, which, by the way, the only thing connected other than power to the new one was this Thunderbolt cable. So I guess it's some sort of like Ethernet over Thunderbolt or what have you. Anyway, it's sampled at 37 megabytes a second. Peer-to-peer Wi-Fi surprisingly sampled at 68 megabytes a second. Not sure how, but, you know, hey, that's what it says. The Thunderbolt to Thunderbolt on this Mac, 882 megabytes per second, which, to be fair, as I watched
on and off.
Wait,
that's all? Mine was 2,000 when I got Thunderbolt working.
Oh, really? Wow, then maybe my cable should be updated to a Thunderbolt Pro cable. But yeah, that's all I saw. And I saw a max of around then, although it would definitely dip lower. It took, I would say, a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours. And I think I had something to the order of 2 or 3 terabytes in use on the old machine. But once I finally convinced it to frickin' use Thunderbolt, it flew. Like, it went real fast. And apparently it would have gone faster if I had a better cable. I didn't even realize, but it was fast.
I mean, it might have picked up speed as it was going, too. Like, here's the thing about those rated speeds. It's not just copying one giant media file, right? So you're not going to see those speeds, because what it's doing is making literally millions of tiny files and directories. And that, and I know there's not a read head moving back and forth, and I know random access is, you know, not that much slower on an SSD than sort of sequential access. But there is more stuff for it to do in terms of I have to read all these different files and all the metadata about the files and all their different attributes. And then I have to write that out. And then the other thing has to receive that and get that information and write it out. And so basically the rule of thumb, which was way more true with spinning disks than it is with SSDs, but it's still true to some degree with SSDs, is that doing tons and tons of little files is way, 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 way slower than doing one gigantic file. And doing Migration Assistance is going to let you copy tons and tons of little files. So you're not going to get the full rated speed, but it will go a lot faster if you have a Thunderbolt connection or something similar.
Yeah. And like I said, I didn't sit there and watch the whole thing because it was literally hours. But I did take a couple of photographs because I don't think I could take screenshots because you can't really do anything while this is going on. But I have a photo that I took, and I'm about 2/3 of the transfer done. So there's about 1/3 remaining. And at this point, I had transferred 4.5 million files. And there was 1 hour and 5 minutes remaining at 551 megabytes a second. So, it's a lot of stuff. But that being said, it seemed to work lickety split. It said it was all done. I start the new machine. I had to do some stuff that it was fairly annoying. Like, I had to redo the whole dance with the audio hijack audio capture engine and like get that to reinitialize itself. I did get all the prompts that Jason has been understandably complaining about, because he's right to complain about it. You know, oh, this wants to look at the desktop. Oh, now it wants to look at your downloads. Oh, now it wants to do this. Oh, this other thing wants to look at the desktop. Can you do that? Hey, well, this. What about this? What about this? What about this? And it was not quite to the level that Jason had, but it was not great. The only real problem I had, and perhaps this was my own lack of patience, I'm not sure, but I went to start grabbing GIFs to send in, like, messages, whatever. And I happen to use Alfred as my, you know, launcher. And Alfred lets you do very quick and easy file system searches. That's not unique to Alfred. And I would type in, you know, the name of a GIF that I knew I had, and I would get nothing. I was like, huh, that's weird. I wonder why. And I thought, well, maybe Alfred has. No, Alfred's just asking Spotlight. So what's going on with Spotlight? Then I tried Spotlight and I tried typing in the same file name, and it's like, nope, I got nothing. I don't know what you're talking about. So I tried via the system preference or system setting or whatever to try to get it to re-index my home folder, and I couldn't get Spotlight or, you know, MD Util.
Oh, wait, why are you trying it to re-index? How long? Like, it has to index it first once, right?
I
so
agree.
Maybe it hadn't finished the first pass yet,
which is why I thought maybe this was user error. But I gave it about a day before I gave up on the fact that it hadn't indexed yet, and I tried doing this in system settings. It didn't get it to go. Eventually I found the MD Util or whatever it is where you tell it, all right, here's what I want you to do it now. And sure enough, within 20 minutes of me saying go ahead and doing whatever incantation I needed to with MD Util to get the re-index to happen, then everything worked pretty much straight away.
You pronounced it Util?
Util.
He also said straight away. We got to call him on his Britishism and his pronunciation. Yeah, at least you have a command line utility, unlike face recognition in photos.
That's
at
true.
Least you can look up what the MD Util incantation is. It's kind of weird that it didn't do it after a day, but it does remind me of like the photo stuff where it's like, hey, laptop, you've been here for a day. When are you going to get around to that first Spotlight pass? And it's like, oh, I don't feel like the time is right yet.
But exactly. At least
you can go to the command line and say, no, the time is right. Do it now.
Exactly. So that was the biggest one of my problems with Spotlight not seeming to want to re-index. But now that that's done, pretty much everything has worked lickety split. I'm sure there's something I'm forgetting that I needed to tweak or fiddle with, but almost everything worked. I'm sorry, not straight away, right away, John.
Thank you.
And it's been really great. And I think part of the reason I was willing to do Migration Assistant rather than start anew was that there was no like nagging software issue that I've been too lazy to properly deal with on the old machine. Like everything seemed fine. I had nothing I was running away from or anything like that. And so if you're in a situation where you don't have any complaints with your current system, Migration Assistant gets two thumbs up from me. Marco, do you want to talk at all about what you ran into, or do we just want to move along?
I mean, I just had a bit of trouble getting Migration Assistant to use the Thunderbolt connection automatically. I was able to solve it within, you know, a half hour, 45 minutes of random troubleshooting and trying different things that people on the internet suggested. This was the first time Migration Assistant has ever not been just super easy and automatic for me. Usually, I'm a Migration Assistant unicorn, I figure after all these years of using it, one time I had to, spend a half hour getting Thunderbolt to connect. Oh, well, you know, worse. There are worse things. Overall, it has worked fine for me every other time. I did learn that target disk mode is kind of gone. I thought that might be easier to make the old Mac go in target disk mode and then just plug the Thunderbolt cable in that way. And that doesn't work anymore. There is Apple Silicon Macs do have a like disk source mode. You gotta like reboot into that recovery environment and launch it from there. But the Migration Assistant process doesn't recognize those. So like, not only does it not work over Thunderbolt, like it doesn't work at all. Migration Assistant just, you cannot use it with target disk mode if the source Mac is an Apple Silicon Mac anymore. That's just unsupported now. So that was kind of a bummer. But otherwise, I did get it working, you know, through Migration Assistant on both computers eventually. And then it was very fast, and I ran it overnight when I went to bed.
Did you have like Ethernet, or did you get on the Wi-Fi at all during that process?
So the first couple times I did it, where I wasn't using Thunderbolt correctly, I had told the computer during its little activation step, here's my Wi-Fi network. Yeah, please proceed. And then whenever I would start it that way, it would never use Thunderbolt. I would even try like running Ethernet between the two computers, and that would work, but it would never switch over to Thunderbolt when that was an option. What I ended up having to do was on the source Mac, before I went into Migration Assistant, set up a Thunderbolt bridge interface in the network settings, give it a static IP address, and then set up internet sharing to share my Wi-Fi to my house over the Thunderbolt bridge. Then, with the new computer, have it reset itself back to its initial state, which it makes very easy, fortunately. And then, when you do that, if you have the Thunderbolt bridge with internet sharing connecting to the new computer won't ask you for your Wi-Fi information. It will activate using the shared internet connection over that Thunderbolt cable to the old computer. And so it bypasses Wi-Fi activation completely, and then the only networking that computer knows at that point is Thunderbolt. And then it works that way every single time. So if you happen to have trouble getting Thunderbolt recognized, have it reset itself. Like, there's the Apple Silicon Macs have this thing during setup where you can say, reset everything back to its initial state. And so you do that. Like, if it fails, you do that, and then it's a very simple process once you learn that Thunderbolt bridge and internet sharing over Thunderbolt bridge trick. There's probably a simpler way to get it to work. I mean, many people have reported that theirs worked just like yours, just totally fine, perfectly. You just plug the cable in and it finds it. And I was trying everything. I found every Thunderbolt cable in my house, which, I mean, there's not that many of them. There's like three. But I tried them all. I tried different configurations. I tried different ports. I tried, like, which computer do you plug into the cable first? When do you plug in? I tried everything before that. Could not.
How long
did
you wait? So Casey's point is, I know this is old data, probably about Intel Max or whatever, but like sometimes you'd plug in the faster thing and it wouldn't find the faster interface immediately, but eventually it would find it. So how long did you let it sit there to see if it's going to find it?
The longest I let it sit for was about 5 or 10 minutes. I went to go brush my teeth and wash off and everything, and then I can't. And it hadn't found it by then, so I figured it wasn't going to find it. And I wanted to go to bed, so I made it work. So I'm like, I'm not gonna let this go, you know, 75 hours or anything. I'm gonna make this go quickly or not at all. So anyway, got it to work eventually. It's now amazing, and I'm very, very happy.
Yeah, the only thing I would say is I did not give the computers any other mechanism to talk to each other other than the Thunderbolt cable. I guess they may have been able to like sort out, and it seems like they sort of did sort out a peer-to-peer Wi-Fi, but like when I talked earlier about it, the Ethernet connection, there was no Ethernet connected to the target computer, the new computer. Granted, my old one was in my normal setup with two displays and, you know, Ethernet and so on and so forth, but the new computer literally only had power and the Thunderbolt cable. I never plugged in Wi-Fi information. I never plugged in an Ethernet adapter. It was just the Thunderbolt. And it took a lot of no reallys and no thank you. No, not Wi-Fi. No. Yes, I'm sure. But eventually, I don't know if it just needed some time, to John's point, to do the handshake before it got satisfied and was happy with me, or what the deal was. But eventually it did give up on having me do the more conventional approach. And once it did that, everything was golden. So. Yeah, these new computers, I love my, I can't stress enough. I loved, but I still do. I say it as though it's dead, but I love my M1 Max MacBook Pro. It is such a phenomenal computer. It is so unreal to have the power of an iMac Pro in your bag. And as much as I'm snarking with Marco about, you know, 16 versus 14, ultimately either one is fine. Like, it doesn't matter. These machines are so friggin' good. The M1s were, and now you're just cranking it up even more. So now, instead of an iMac, an old and busted, you know, Intel computer, because who would want to use those? Now, instead of that in my bag, I've got a Mac Studio in my bag. You know what I mean? And the screen is so good. And I do feel like I'm probably, you know, incepting myself, or I'm telling myself that it's true. But I do feel like I noticed in the brighter area in Wegmans today that the standard def stuff was just a touch brighter than I'm used to. That the screens are phenomenal. The keyboards are great. It's got plenty of ports. Like, everything about these machines is so freaking great. I cannot stress enough. If you have the means, I highly suggest you picking one up. And honestly, even an M2 or M1 MacBook Pro, particularly an M2 or M1 Max MacBook Pro, they are so, so good. We are in such a golden time for the Mac, and I'm so thankful for it and so in love with it. This is such a great time. No matter what you get, even if you don't want a pro, the M2 MacBook Air is great. Aaron has an M1 MacBook Air. Other than not having MagSafe, which bums me out a little bit, that's great. Like, all of these machines are so freaking good right now.
Yeah.
If you are still on Intel, if you're still on Intel, for the love of all that's good and holy, treat yourself first to an ATP bit of merch. But after you buy your ATP merch, treat yourself to a computer. Because they are so, so good now.
And if you can find like a used M1 Max MacBook Pro, that is probably a steal now. Because no, it's not going to be as fast as the M3 is going to be twice as fast or whatever. But like, it's such a good computer and you're getting such a bargain. It's kind of like buying a very fancy car. They depreciate so fast. The higher end ones depreciate so fast. So it may be hard to find an M1 MacBook Air for one third of the price, but I bet you can find a well-configured M1 Max for one third of what it was new. I know everyone wants the Black Friday sales to find I want an M3 Max for $150 off. Look at the M1 Maxes. MacBook Pros, like, they're such a good deal now because, you know, the M2 is here and the M3 is here, but the M1 Max, to Marco's point, was such a great machine. And if you can get it for a bargain, especially one that's spec'd up, because that's the whole thing. Like, you know, someone paid an extra $800 for that RAM. You're not going to pay an extra $800 for that config when you buy it 2 years after it was introduced. So hunt for those bargains.
Yeah, that's a good point. Similar to cars, like, you pay a lot for those options at purchase, but at resale, they're worth a lot less. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, similar to that, like, you know, when, as Jeremy was saying, like, when you buy a used computer, or even just like a closeout, you know, last year's model computer that's still technically new, but just not the newest model, you pay a lot less for those RAM and SSD upgrades than they do when they're new. That could, like, I personally would rather have a used M1 Max MacBook Pro than a brand new, like, you know, low spec, you know,
like base
MacBook
model
Air.
Like, where you get, like, if you could get an M1 Max with, like, you know, 4 terabytes versus an M3 Max with 512, go to the M1 Max all day. Like, you're not, you know, the base config, when you're, especially on a laptop where you're constrained on RAM or storage, that's going to annoy you so much more than the speed will thrill you. Like, so get the M1 Max with the more SSD and the more RAM.
Yeah. And I'm just so happy, again, being in the laptop world. Like, right now, you know, honestly, I feel like if I was a big fan of Apple's desktops right now, I would feel a little left out. And I was in the desktop world for so long, I know what that's like. But the reality is Apple's desktop market, it feels kind of like the iPad multitasking market, where it's like, here's a thing that some people care a lot about, and it seems like if you care a lot about Apple desktops, you care more about Apple desktops than Apple cares about Apple desktops.
I don't think that's entirely true. Like, we focus a lot about how they've really screwed up with the Mac Pro, and I kind of agree. But the fact that the Studio exists is such a great change from before it existed. Like, because you're just saying desktops, you're not saying Mac Pro, right?
No, I'm saying including both desktops. Because I think what I'm getting at is, like, right now, the Mac Pro or the MacBook Pro has all the best processors in the Apple lineup for most metrics. Like, the 14 and 16 inch MacBook Pro, like the M3 Max, is actually better in certain ways than the M2 Ultra. And so right now, if you want the fastest Mac at certain things, at many things, it's a laptop. And I feel like if you're in the desktop world, the Mac Studio is always kind of playing second fiddle to the MacBook Pro now. Because of its release schedule.
It's just a staggered release schedule. I mean, like, when the Ultra comes out, when the Ultra came out of the Mac Studio, it was twice as fast because it had two Maxes in it. Right. It was just straightforward. And if you got the desktop, you got to enjoy that twice as fastness until the M3 Max comes out. But guess what? There's going to be two M3 Maxes stuck together in an M3 Ultra, and then you'll be twice as fast again. It's a staggered release. And you're right. Right now, M3 Max is the fastest. And for most things, except for GPU stuff, where the Ultras tend to still win. But that will change when they come out. So, yeah, it would be great if they were all put out together, especially since, like, they do sell Mac Studios with the M3 Max. Why don't we have that now? Oh, I don't know. They don't have enough of them to go around. They sell more laptops or whatever. But I honestly don't feel like the Mac desktop line is particularly neglected. I feel like the Mac Pro is in a bad spot. But fact that there's the Mini and the Studio is an embarrassment of riches in recent decades when it comes to desktop Macs that don't have have a screen. You know what I mean? So I'm not super mad about it. And, you know, I think an M3 Max or an M3 Ultra Mac Studio is going to be a pretty amazing desktop machine, all things considered. So, yeah, right now, laptops has always been in a great place. And right now, due to the staggered release schedule and the fact that they're not giving you a Mac Studio with the M3 Max, like, I kind of understand it because they want to roll out the Max and Ultra in the studio at the same time. But I don't think the desktop line is neglected. The Mac Pro is kind of sad over there.
Yeah, no, it's more just like, you know, there's going to be, you know, if they continue this release pattern, then there's always going to be this like 6 or 8 month span where the MacBook Pro is in some ways better than the Mac Studio.
Yeah, but that conditional you put at the beginning there, I think for the first 3 generations of Apple Silicon, what we've learned is that it's very difficult to discern any kind of pattern. Is it because just, well, this, you know, stuff happens or whatever? But boy, the M1 to M2 to M3 has not been a regular predictable cadence of anything. It's been so weird. Like in the M1, like, okay, it's the first one. It's going to be weird, but then we'll get a rhythm going. Nope. Just, you never know what's going to happen. The 3-nanometer thing threw everything off. The fact that we got M3, M3 Pro and M3 Max at the same time, where we had never gotten that before. So who the heck knows what it's going to be like in M4, but I guess we'll find out.
All right. Hi, Future Marco.
Hey.
We are only an hour.
I'm going to ask ATP because Marco said it's a long after show.
Well, I was
not
actually
long,
gonna
maybe
suggest...
20 minutes.
I still think we should go. We're at almost 90 minutes and we're going to ask ATP in an after show.
Holy God, hear me out, my friend. I was going to say, let's skip Ask ATP because do we really need a 2-hour, 20-minute show this week? Why don't we just skip
ATP? I think we have time for both of them, and I do want to get to the Ask ATP.
All right, let's do it.
All right, let's do some Ask ATP. Richard Levitt writes, what exactly is a neural engine? I imagine it to be something akin to a database search optimizations, but it seems it must... I said A in there. Let me reboot that. Yep. Hello again, Future Marco.
Hey.
I was going to let that cruise, and it just made my skin crawl. So let me try that one all over again. All right, let's do some Ask ATP. Richard Levitt writes, what exactly is a neural engine? I imagine it to be something akin to database search optimizations, but it seems it must be more than that. So what's going on there?
Yeah, this is a good question. The short answer is, for me personally, I don't know. But the long answer is, I don't need to know specifics because I know what it is in general. We'll put a link in the show notes to, I thought we had a link to a video about this. Maybe we just have a link to the documentation on GitHub to Google's TPU, Tensor Processing Unit, which is a similar type of thing. Here's what you need to know about the neural engine and lots of things that are on the SoC that have names that are not like the CPU or GPU to a lesser extent. When you have something that you know you're going to need to do a lot of, and it's very regular, you could have the general purpose CPU do it because, hey, the general purpose CPU can do all the math. It can do multiplication, division, addition, and subtraction. It can do bit shifts. It can do masks. It can do all of those things. And it can do a bunch of them at the same time, and it can reorder instructions so it can keep those execution units running. It can do it. It's a general purpose processor, right? But what if you know actually what I'm going to need to do is take this huge list of numbers and add every single one of them in a particular pattern to this other huge list of numbers, and then put the result in another huge list. And I'm going to need to do that just so many times you can't even imagine. You could send all those numbers to the CPU. Here's number one from the third set. Here's the first one from the second one. Please add them together. Take the result. Write it back into memory in this location. Okay, here's the next number. And you can have 5 of them going at once because you have 5 execution units in the CPUs and you're going through.
Well, we have vector instructions. I mean,
Yeah, I know. That's the next thing. Right?
So MMX.
So CPUs also have a thing, you know, that's like SIMD, a single instruction, multiple data. It's like, do I really need to add individual numbers? What if I could add together 5 numbers at the same time? I'll just pack all those 5 numbers into a single thing. Send it to the SIMD engine. Here's 5 numbers and 5 other numbers in a single operation. Those 5 numbers all get added to the other 5 numbers. I take those 5 results and put them in a new location. That's 5 times faster. That's amazing. SIMD, every CPU core has some kind of thing. I forget what they call it for ARM. Is it like neon instructions or something? It's not called MMX, right? But that's still the general purpose CPU. You're like, no, you don't understand. I don't have like 5 numbers to add together. I have like 300,000 numbers to add together. And you're going to be doing literally the same operation to all of them, right? Let's say it's like matrix operations, but you can look up on a Wikipedia page what the various operations you can perform to matrices. There's a rule book. You take this from there and that from there and do that to this and put the results over there. And you just do it over and over again. So the neural engine, a lot of the algorithms that you have to run for these, you know, machine learning, neural processing, inference, whatever things, are like that. You're going to have to do something over and over again to just so many numbers. And doing five of them at once or 10 of them at once, that's not really going to cut it. The TPU, I'll try to find a link to the video for the show notes, but the TPU stuff, here's some specs. Obviously, the TPU is an entire gigantic thing that only does stuff kind of like the Neural Engine does, but it's custom designed to just do this one thing. So instead of having a one or two little adders and they pull from memory and they add the numbers together and write the result back into memory, they sit there and say, all right, give me the first 100,000 numbers. And give me the other group of 100,000 numbers. Now I'm going to smush them all together and now I'll write the result out. And that's all they do. They can't do any other. They're not like general purpose processors. They're like, they're made to do this, right? So here's some numbers from the TPU thing, right? Which again is much bigger than Neural Engine, but it gives you an idea of the scales here. The TPU can do 250,000 operations per clock cycle. Good so great. Your general purpose CPU, you turn the crank, one clock cycle goes by. It's like, I added five numbers together. Good job, general purpose CPU. I added 250,000 numbers together in that same clock cycle. And the other thing is, how many operations per instruction? 256 million operations per instruction. You can send it one instruction that says, hey, take these 256 million, take these 175 million things. And like, such, because they know it's like, I'm not going to send you to these onesie twosie. I'm not going to pack them into groups of five or 10 to do a SIMD. I'm just going to tell you there's 100 million numbers over here and another 100 million numbers over here. Smush them together and write the new 100 million out in the other place. Ready, go. One instruction, right? 250,000 operations per cycle. That's what the Neural Engine does. Obviously not on that scale because it's a tiny little thing, but it has functional units that are designed to do the specific thing that they know you need to do for various machine learning algorithms. And those things need to do some brain dead simple thing over and over again on huge lists of number. And they do not want to be fed those numbers onesie twosie. They want to get them all at once, smush them together through this gigantic, massively parallel machine, like in a single turn of the crank, and then do that over and over again. That's what the Neural Engine. Now, what are those operations? What is it doing? Is it doing multiply accumulate? Is it doing matrix transformations? I don't actually know, right? But it doesn't matter. That's what this thing, that's what these functional units do. And it's even more kind of like, not brain dead, but like simple and parallelizable than things like the H.265 encoder, because that has a job to do like encoding and decoding video. But that is a much more complicated job than what these things do. These are just like, think of them as just huge rows of these machines and one big crank at the end, and you turn it and it doesn't process five widgets, it processes hundreds or thousands of widgets all in each turn of the crank. That's where you get the bang for the buck for the Neural Engine.
Mike Hoffman writes, with regard to Apple beta OSs, how often is it appropriate to report the same bug? Do you report it after every update, or do you wait until the GM release and report it again if it still exists? Well, since Apple's feedback mechanism is totally fucking broken, then you should do it hourly, because that's the only way you have a chance of them noticing it. So hourly is our answer. Moving on, Santiago writes.
No, the answer. So here's the thing.
It depends who you ask.
It's difficult to know what the right thing to do is. I'll give you an example of my window dragging bug, which continues to drag on. I'll tell you what I chose to do there and how that's working out for me. So what I chose to do is what I usually choose to do is file a bug. And I've heard very often from people inside Apple that if the conditions change in some way, it might be a good idea to file a new report. Maybe the old one got chucked in the trash can. Maybe the old one didn't have enough information. Maybe the other one is caught in, you know, limbo somewhere or whatever. Like, say something has changed. There's a new beta that comes out. Or in my case, you've learned new information about the bug. Oh, I found a better isolation. I was mistaken about what I thought caused it. I filed the bug against the wrong component. When you do a bug report, it makes you pick, like, what is this bug about? And it's a pop-up menu. And there is an other choice, but I always fear the other choice, because now I'm, like, at the whims of whoever, like triages the others. But then the other choices are, like, I don't know, what is, like, window dragging. Needless to say, there's no choice for window drag. There's a system performance choice, which is kind of good, but, like, when I'm filing a bug against, if you're filing against a bug against an app, there's probably a choice for, like, photos or whatever. But anyway, it's hard to know where you're filing it. And so if you learn something new about this bug and you say, like, oh, I thought it was a bug in X, but it's really a bug in Y, file a new one, right? If a new version of the OS comes out and it's still happening in that new OS, file a new one, partially because I imagine and that if there's a bug filed against the OS that they just released, those get more priority than bugs that you filed against the previous version, because it's like, ah, that was the old version. We're not looking at those bugs so much anymore. But, oh, we just released a new version and there's a bug against that. Maybe that gets looked at more. The downside of that approach is, as I found out with my Window Dragon bug, from what I have heard, work is happening on my Window Dragon bug, but it's happening attached to one of my older reports from an older version, which is a shame because all my new good information is in the new reports. Like, as I've learned more and I've refiled against new versions of the OS, but it happened to get picked up a while ago on one of the early versions. So now I have my effort. I was going to say the feedback scattered around, but let's be honest, there's no feedback, right? Although there is a tiny bit. Apparently some metadata changed recently on one of them that said that a fix is coming or whatever. But anyway, I haven't gotten any replies on any of them. By filing multiple reports, you're not sure which one of those, if any, is actually being worked on by Apple. So, and if they are working on one, maybe they're not working on the one that you're putting your effort into. You keep adding new comments. Oh, I've discovered new things. Here's a better sample project. Here's a new screen recording. Here's a new sysdiagnose. Oh, the new version came out and I retested and it's still there and I filed a new bug. You may think you're doing important work, but it could be that that bug is being worked on by the second one you filed like a year ago, right? So as with all things, I don't know how best to handle this, but I would say filing new bugs is probably a good idea, because if you filed one, two versions of macOS ago, and you're like, I hope they get to that one eventually. If it still exists, refile against the new OS. If a new beta comes out and it's still there, if you don't refile, add a new comment that says, hey, just so you know, I tested this in the new beta and it's still there. Is that the right or best thing to do? We do what we can out here. We throw stuff over the wall and we hope it sticks. But I think the only thing I can definitively say is the wrong thing to do is assume that the one bug you filed a while ago is sufficient, because it almost certainly isn't.
Yeah, I mean, this is just... So a long time ago, a deep cut on this show maybe, I discussed a challenge that I had against one of Apple's APIs where my solution was to build an automatic kicking machine, which is, this was a terrible hack that, like, when you're exporting a share clip from Overcast, sometimes the video encoding API that I'm using to generate the share clip video files, some deep Apple API, sometimes it just hangs. And the only solution is to just cancel it and restart it. And so I actually built this process in the clip sharing feature where, like, it observes the progress. And if the progress stalls for too long, it just cancels it and starts over. And I describe it on the show as an automatic kicking machine. This is kind of how we are treating Apple's bug reporting system. And how Apple employees tell us to treat it. The fundamental problem is the Apple bug reporting system is just hopelessly, deeply, massively broken and dysfunctional at every possible level, and it reflects a huge amount of problems that the company has internally managing itself, and then also the problems it has managing any kind of both feedback or communication or QA or prioritization from the outside world. Every part of this system in the company is dysfunctional and inefficient at best. And so we are told by many Apple employees over and over again, you got to file bugs often. Yes, it helps. File them often. Oh, and every Apple employees have told us, every single beta, refile your bugs that aren't fixed yet as new bugs, new copies. Not even, don't just go and comment on the old one. Refile them. Now, what this does is it takes a massively broken system and just breaks it more. And so the official word from Apple, the unofficial word from Apple employees is always for us to dump more of our time and effort into this broken system, wasting our time even more so that they can avoid fixing their problems on their end, their deep fundamental problems in this area. We should collectively all waste all of our time way more to make their dysfunctional system work slightly better for them. What I say is, F that, I'm going to just complain in the press. Because, as you know, running to the press never helps. But the reality
is, always does.
Yeah, it always does. And so, yeah, maybe file a bug, but also talk about it as much as you possibly can. Talk about it on Mastodon, make blog posts about it. If you have a podcast, talk about it on the podcast. Because really, what helps with Apple to get over their broken bug system is public attention on something. What helps, it's like many other parts of Apple, What helps is the right people seeing it. And if you go through the plain bug filtering system that you have, you know, that you get in the feedback assessment, like to get through that, the odds of anyone ever seeing that, I'm convinced, are very, very low. The odds of like the right people seeing it, like people who could actually maybe do anything about it, are even lower than that. And then the odds that those people will actually have time to fix your bug seem even lower than that. And so you have to treat a bug that you care about like something that needs marketing. Like, you have to market your bug. You can't just submit it in the background in Feedback Assistant and hope it will get fixed. It won't. You have to get in public and talk on Twitter and talk on Mastodon and talk on Threads and whatever else. Get it out there and market your bug if you want Apple to have any chance of fixing it. And no, this system absolutely should not work this way. There's so many problems with this, but it's the truth. If you don't market your bug, it won't be fixed.
And, you know, recognize it's kind of hard to market your bug when you don't have a tech podcast. Maybe you don't have a popular blog. It's even difficult to say, okay, well, I don't have a popular blog. Maybe a popular blog will pick it up. Like, we recognize this is not great advice.
No,
for
this is why
regular
it's so
people
broken.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but we're just saying, you know, and we're saying, oh, well, you think that works because that's worked for you. And yes, it has worked for us. Maybe there are other things that work for people without any kind of public platform. But honestly, there's so few things that we found to work that it's worth communicating. This is one approach that has worked, even though we recognize it is not a solution for pretty much anybody except for this tiny, weird minority of people who do have an audience. Although I still even, you know, I think about the Air Network Change thing, which, yes, we did have something to follow up about it, but I got pushed next week. Don't worry. It hasn't gone away. this is a bug that's been hanging around apparently since 2019. I only really heard about it when it started happening to me. And that's a similar story to other people, right? You'll know when this bug is getting close to being fixed by whoever is responsible for fixing, when there's like a Verge story about it, or a network change plaguing people who use Chrome-based things. Like, that's when you, like, let's say it's not somebody's pet bug, like my Photos thing or my Window Dragon thing that I constantly talk about on my stupid podcast, right? Let's say it's something more general, like our network change, which is happening to lots of people, right? What's going to cause that to get fixed? No one who's working on Chrome or has any control over this is probably listening to this podcast because that's really not our focus, right? But if there's a story on The Verge about it, right, or some popular tech website, or like the big thing with Apples and keyboards, there's a New York Times story about Air Network Changed or Butterfly Keyboards or whatever, you can be sure that Apple is paying attention now. And it goes from the top down, right? It's not like the people in the rank file don't want to fix your bug. They would love to fix your bug. There's nothing.
No one gives them the time to fix it.
If you're not a programmer, you might not know this, but most people who are programmers, especially good programmers, if you have responsibility for something, whatever it is, I work on the DNS subsystem on the Mac, or I have the sound things, or I work on these APIs on iOS or whatever, the last thing you want is to know that there's some bug in the new version of the thing that you just released and not be allowed to fix it, not be given time to fix it. You want to fix it. You don't want to put out code that's like, oh, I made a dumb mistake. Oh, I see what it is. You want to get that fixed out as soon as possible. But if you work in a big organization, A, getting a bug fixed out, quote, as soon as possible could take weeks or months. And B, you might not even be allowed to do that because you've got a bunch of other stuff you're supposed to be doing and you don't get to set your own priorities. And it's only when some vice president sees a story on The Verge that they talk to their person below them, or talks to their person below them, talks to their person below them, that finally they say, hey, that bug you've been wanting to fix for 6 months, now you have 2 days to do it. Go. Right? That's how things work in big companies. And it sounds dysfunctional, but if it didn't work this way, programmers would just spend their entire time gold plating the one corner of the functionality they're responsible for. We'd never have any new features. So you have to find a balance between those two ends of the spectrum. Obviously, we often think Apple is way too far in the direction of ignoring bugs, but you can go too far in the other direction too. I would love to see Apple go too far in the other direction for a change of pace, but I'm not holding my breath. So right now, the best we're doing is, you know, complaining on podcasts and trying to drag Apple kicking and streaming a little bit more towards the gold plating angle, which is a businessy phrase that maybe people haven't heard and maybe it's out of date or whatever, but I can't think of a better name for the other one, the other end of the spectrum. But yeah, they're way too far on the end of the spectrum where bugs just go unfixed for years and years, unless they get a story in The Verge, unless they get a New York Times story, unless some senior vice president actually notices. You know, and with the Air Network change, it has the great thing about it of, like, it's not even clear whose bug it is. Is it Apple's fault? Is it Chrome's fault? Is it both of them? Is it neither? It's just like a problem that users are encountering, and it's not severe enough to cause to appear as a story at anywhere except for here, but maybe someday it will be.
Santiago writes, I just noticed that when you geotag photos in the Mac Photos app, the location information is not added to the file metadata. It's probably kept somewhere in the library. Quick aside, I think this is true for music as well, which is frustrating, but nevertheless. Santiago continues, this means that when using some backup solutions, that data will be missing. Is there any way to take the location information from the photos library and add it to their respective photos? This is why I process all that junk before ingestion into photos. I don't know if there's a way, or I'll ask my co-host here in a second, but this is I view photos as kind of a lens into my photo library rather than the bespoke or the I can't think of the word I'm looking for, the one true version of the photo library. And that's probably dumb of me, and I'm probably missing out on some things, but that's the way I treat it, because I just I want the files to stand on their own and have all that metadata, just like Santiago does. So John is our in photos expert, I guess. Is there a way to do this that you know of?
Yeah, so first thing is that feature that is described here, the fact that, like, hey, there's what's in the file, but then there's also this separate stuff that's in the library, and the library stuff takes precedence when you're viewing it through the lens of Apple Photos, but then it's not written to the file and backup programs don't see that. That is also kind of a feature in certain scenarios. One of the features that I've talked about Apple Photo Library that I love is you can do all sorts of stuff to your photo knowing that the original is still there. Crop it, alter it, do all this stuff. None of that gets baked in, right? So you always can say, oh, I've changed my mind. Oh, I do it frequently. I'll go back to a photo that I edited 7 years ago, and I'll be like, you know what? I'm better at photo editing now. Let me undo most of that and redo it better. And there's no problem, because the changes you made in photos were written to the photos library, not to your file. Your file is unmodified. So that's great, right? But in this case, like, well, what about stuff that I really like? It's not like edits or whatever. I just would rather have the date in the photo. The good thing about Apple's photo library, and I think also about their music library, is this is one of the rare cases where Apple has public, open, supported third-party interfaces to the photo library. It doesn't help you as a user unless you can find an app that does it. But technically speaking, like, is there a way to take that location information from photos and add it to their from the library and add it to the photos? There is a way. You'd have some code that someone wrote in an app that would read the library and write that data out to the photos and modify them, right? Someone could 100% write that program. Maybe they already exist. Maybe next week 50 people will send us a bunch of app suggestions or whatever. But, like, this is one of those cases where it's not like, oh, Apple doesn't let you do that and there's no API for that. There is. There is an API for doing all of that. You could do this. One could do this. If there are not lots of apps like this, it may reflect the fact that most people are like, it's in the photo library, it's fine, I don't care. Like, not everybody cares like Casey does of having it baked into the file, or like Santiago does. But I'm saying it's technically possible. So I'm hoping somewhere out there is an app that could do this. There's also command line tools and other things that you could potentially do this for. Obviously, Casey does it like upfront with his own tools before he goes to the photo library. But if the dates are in the library, yes, there is a way for one to programmatically get that data out. And there also is a way for one to programmatically write that to a photo file. That is all technically possible and supported without any weird hacks or whatever. It's just a question of whether somebody wrote that app.
Oh, Marco, any thoughts?
No. That is it, right? Okay.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thanks to our sponsor this week, Notion, and thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join, and we will talk to you next week.
Marco, I heard some rumblings that you had some sort of hardware-related, like, and I don't mean computing, I mean hardware store-related project, which means you presumably made something between 5 and 500 trips to Home Depot recently?
Not Home Depot. Fortunately, this was with a local hardware store in town. So this was for the this was for the new house. I was over there today, and this new house is still not livable. You know, because there's not a bathroom yet. We're working on that, but in the meantime, the HVAC people had installed some, you know, dumb thermostats. Even though I had requested smart thermostats, and in particular, I had requested Nest thermostats. Now, I had the very first generation Nest thermostats a million years ago. They're in the house that we are selling. I'm not taking my ancient Nest thermostats with me. They're staying with the house. They are quite old. Some of them have, like, you know, lines through the screens and everything, but they still work. Anyway, So those, you know, the new ones are a lot nicer. The old ones look pretty old now. The screens are like super tiny by comparison, and everything's really thick. Anyway, at the beach, when I smartified these thermostats, I tried Nest first, and it gave me all sorts of problems with connectivity, because the walls here are very thick and radio signals aren't very, you know, effective here. They get blocked really easily. Wi-Fi is very challenging here. But I had constant problems with the modern Nests, and I ended up giving them all away and switching over to the Ecobee HomeKit smart thermostats. And so here, that's what we have at the beach, Ecobees. And the Ecobee thermostats started out being a little more ugly and clunky than the Nests, but at least they were HomeKit, and at least I was done with the Nest hardware. And then they kept getting software updates that make them even worse somehow. Like, the Ecobee recently redesigned their interface to do things like change the temperature of the thermostat on the thermostat, which you would think would be an action that they would optimize the design to do. And this is always something that Nest was fantastic at. And now Nest makes a whole bunch of thermostats, some of which are like those really, like, they made like a really cheap version. And by the way, and I know, Upgrade Plus listeners, I know Jason Snell is literally just making the opposite move, like, right now. So we'll see. Maybe Jason, maybe I'll mail you a whole bunch of Ecobees someday when I replace all these. But anyway, Ecobee has worked fine with my HomeKit setup. It doesn't work exactly as well as I would want it to. Like, when you look at HomeKit secure video cameras, which, again, I've had my issues with my Logitech Circle Views. Maybe I'll mail those to Jason, too. Don't get Circle Views. HomeKit secure video, the way it works, when you set up a device that uses it, for most things, including the Logitech ones, that's, like, all they do. Like, they might have their own separate app, but they're really first and foremost designed for HomeKit secure video. That's not the way Ecobees are with HomeKit thermostats. It's more like, okay, yeah, we'll talk to HomeKit, but that's not what we're designed to do. Ecobee wants you to use their own app. It's very similar to Nest in like the type of problems it tries to solve. It tries to get you to do all these efficient things and be smart and automatically adjust your temperature and all this stuff. Most of which I disable because it doesn't really work very well for people who work at home. It's not really optimized for that. The Ecobees, I have had moderate mixed success with. I don't hate them enough to replace them, but I don't like them enough to buy any more of them. And the recent update to the UI and the Ecobees makes it so that if you want to change the temperature on the thermostat, it takes something like 5 or 6 taps. And a decent amount of time is you have to wait for it to, like, wake up and then animate into a few different positions, and then you can adjust it. And it's so error-prone, I don't know what they were thinking with this update. Like, it's bad. And the Ecobees, they don't look as good as the Nest even to start with. Even when they're off, they don't look as good. So it's a downgrade. Anyway, the new house that we're renovating is a much simpler, more traditional layout. The thermostats are just, there's one upstairs, one downstairs. They're both in the middle of the hallway, so they get great Wi-Fi coverage from anywhere. So it's a much easier thing. So I said, you know what? Let me go back to Nest, because the Ecobees are just so annoying to use. I'll just do Nest. So, get there. The HVAC people, we have all new, brand new HVAC systems, because this house was, we're heavily renovating it, because it was a very old house that was really not kept up much. You know, the previous residents were very old, and they couldn't really keep it up. Anyway, so it's kept up now. We're renovating everything. Brand new HVAC systems. They installed the wrong thermostats. I'm like, all right, let me just do this myself. Like, we're trying to get everything done as quickly as possible so we can move in. I'll just do the thermostats myself. I got the 2 Google Nests. So I go there today. I'm like, all right, great. Look around the house. First of all, there was no one working today. So there was no one around to, like, you know, help out or borrow tools from. And I look around the house, and there are no tools anywhere. Like, this is a construction site. But they clean it up pretty well. And so there was, like, you know, buckets of nails and, you know, a dumpster full of drywall fragments. But there's no tools. There is one little area of the house where we were able to, like, shove a few of our things and not have them be touched. And in that one little area, I found a small battery-powered drill that had one bit, the Phillips bit. I'm like, okay, that's, I can do something with that. So I was able to take the old thermostats off. And fortunately, the, you know, once you get in there, the wires are all these little press wires. And what I learned when I opened up the Nest actually comes with, I got the nicer Nest, like the old kind with the turning knob, because they're more pleasant to use. And they let you change the temperature really easily on them, a feature that Echo Bee should learn. Anyway, so the Nest actually comes with a little tiny screwdriver to like take off the old thermostat's wiring, and you can pop it in the new one. So anyway, so I'm like, all right, I have basic tools, a little tiny flathead screwdriver and a medium-sized Phillips screwdriver and this drill. And I was able to get one of them installed just fine. But I noticed when I did the wiring, like, wow, the wire colors on this are not at all what I've seen on any other thermostat before. Now, I have probably installed now between the two great waves of Nests and Echo Bees, I have probably installed something like 8 smart thermostats, like, you know, in all these different places and different generations of the hardware. I've installed a decent number of smart thermostats. I've never seen the color scheme that the installers of the new system used. So, I trying to figure out, like, what the heck are these wires? Like, where is the common wire? What is this blue one? Why, like, there's all these colors, and I'm, like, looking up on my phone, what the heck are these colors? Well, I'm like, you know, if I had a multimeter, I could just test them and see where, you know, where is the 24 volts AC? Like, where is it, between this and this, or this and this? And I didn't want to, like, you know, start just short them together to, like, see, oh, does, if I short these two together, does the heat turn on? Like, I didn't want to start doing that. Before I knew what I was shorting together. So I'm like, all right, well, let me, if I just had that. And then one of the wires they hadn't connected yet, like they hadn't connected the AC stuff. They'd only connected heat because it was the bare minimum to like keep the work going through this cold month. So I'm like, let me connect the AC also. I might as well. And I'm going to need a multimeter to figure out which of these wires has that. And they're not even stripped. So I'm like, all right, so let me just run to the hardware store real quick. There's a hardware store right in town. I'll get a cheap multimeter and a cheap wire stripper and I'll get this going. And all of my other stuff at this point is a 45-minute or a half-hour drive away, like over the sand. Like, I'm not going to go all the way back, you know, to get all my other stuff. So I'm like, all right, let me just go to the hardware store right in town. So trip number one, multimeter and wire strippers. Great. Go back to the house, figure it out. Okay, I'm pretty sure I know what these wires do. And just let me just test. I've measured the voltages. They're all right. Let me just test. I'm pretty sure this one's the air conditioning wire. It's blue. That seems like it would make sense. It's not standard, but it's at least something. It's the only other wire here. Let me try. I connected that wire to the other one, and a little spark formed between the two wires. And I'm like, that's probably not good.
That's not good.
And then it stopped working. Like, then there was no voltage in any of the wires. I'm like, oh, crap. Did I just break my brand new HVAC unit?
Well, if you're going to break somebody's thing, breaking your own works out.
Yeah, so I'm like, all right, what now? What? How do I solve this problem? Like, all right, I think I just broke something. And at first I tried, let me just go flip the breaker off, wait a minute, flip it back on, see if I can reset whatever needs to be reset. Did that, no luck. I'm like, oh, man.
You're getting to the point where now you realize you're going to have to explain to the people you're paying to fix your house that you're like, you know, when you weren't there, I decided I'm going to play contractor and pretend that I can fix the house, but I broke it.
Yes, that's what I was dreading. I'm like, oh man, I got to figure out how to fix this myself. Like, I don't want to have to call the HVAC people back to like, look, hey, I tried to do this. I just broke my/your brand new system.
It's like if they came to you and said, yeah, we made a bunch of changes to the overcast code and now it doesn't compile anymore. We're not sure what we did. Anyway, we uploaded that build to the App Store. Just, can you fix it?
Yeah, right. Like, I'm like, I felt like such an idiot. I'm like, oh man, like I should not have
done
this.
So have you decided at this point, to avoid that, you're going to dig further? It sounds like you did, considering you made more trips.
Yes. Well, so it was time for lunch. So I go have lunch. And as I'm, you know, eating my quick microwave, whatever, I'm looking up like YouTube videos, like, you know, what if a Bosch air handler doesn't have any, and I somehow found through web searches and Reddits and stuff like that, I somehow stumbled upon something saying, an HVAC installer saying, hey, these people keep blowing their control board fuse, And somebody else was like, oh, that's usually what happens when there's a short somewhere in the thermostat wiring.
It happens when homeowners start connecting wires they don't know what to do in the Spark forums.
Right. And I'm like, oh, I shorted my control wiring probably. And then I did more research into that. And it's like, oh, yeah, this tends to happen, especially if you short the common wire directly to the other side, you know, the other side of the transformer. Then it'll blow this fuse instantly. And it's one of those little tiny, like, automotive little 5-amp fuses on the control board. I'm like, great. This is almost definitely what I just did. Like it everything lined up. I definitely shorted the common wire to the R wire. Definitely. Okay. So I go back to the house and I like go into the crawl space under the house, find the new air handler. I'm like, all right, how can I get to this control board? And it has really big flathead screws that hold the panel on top of the control board. And I don't have a flathead screwdriver.
You don't have a dime because you're not living in the 50s with change in your pockets.
I scoured the house for anything
coins.
That could. Yeah, I didn't find. I thought of coins. I couldn't find anything that could be a big flathead screwdriver. I tried the little one that I had. It was way too small. Wouldn't turn it at all. Like it was like nothing I had anywhere in the house. I'm looking around. I'm like looking at the strips of nail gun nails that look like ammo, and I'm like, maybe if I like use the side
use
of,
the
one
edge
of, those,
of one of
like,
those, yeah. I should feel like if you were like even just in our parents' generation. I know that my dad, when I was growing up, when he came home from work and he emptied out his pockets, he was always emptying change out of one of the pockets. Like he had his wallet, he had his keys, but he always had like loose coins, and that just is not the way I live my life as an adult at his age, at the age he was. Like, yeah, having dads constantly having change in their pocket is not a thing.
Yeah,
anymore,
and like, and I'm not like a knife guy either, so I don't have like I don't have knives in my pocket.
Yeah, you don't have your Leatherman strapped to your belt for 364 days. So on the 365th,
right, yeah,
you can unscrew these big screws.
Yeah.
What I'm learning is you need to really refine your EDC after this experience.
Yeah, right.
Or you could just have a box of tools at the house that's being worked on. But
yeah,
or you
right.
just let the people who you're paying to work on it. Anyway, there's many solutions here. But continue. What did you actually?
Yeah. So and I'm like I'm pretty sure it is this blown fuse. I don't want to have to make two more trips. Like, but I don't, because I don't know how big and what kind of fuse. So like, I can't just go buy a fuse and a screwdriver in the same trip.
You
so
got to take the donkey across with the chicken,
yes,
but you don't want to bring the hay at the same time. But you, oh, okay.
Yeah. So first I had to go buy a screwdriver, then go back to the house, take the cover off, find the fuse, pull it out. Yeah, sure enough, it is very blown. And then go back to the hardware store a third time saying, I need this, please. I bought a 5-pack. So I'm like, you know, first of all, it's all they come in. And second of all, I'm like,
you're planning
I'm probably going to need
a few more
this
times.
Anyway, finally got it all back, popped it in. It worked perfectly. I took my brand new screwdriver and screwed the cover back on. And I was able to do it. And then, sure enough, that was indeed the common wire. Apparently, they are sometimes blue now. And so now, finally, I have my Nest thermostats in the house. And now I have to just have them patch the giant space-out holes they made with the wrong thermostats.
Yeah, think about these smart thermostats and the pressing connectors. The thing that I was always fearing when I was messing with mine is that the cable with all those various wires is just barely long enough to reach, you know, because you have to kind of connect it to the, and I was like, if I screw this up, like if I like bend it back and forth too many times and like the stripped end breaks off or whatever, like I'd have to like go to the basement and somehow free some slack somehow to go up through the walls, and it's just so precarious with these tiny little wires and these little press connectors. Like for all the, you know, that we complained about like computer connectors, the lack of connectors with just like house wiring is, you know, especially if you're in a very old house, because a new house is like, oh, a good electrician will leave you lots of slack and the wires are very robust and they're sturdy. And but if you have an old house, I mean, you don't have that excuse. This is new construction. But in my old house, the wires are just barely long enough to reach and older than everybody in your family combined. And so just ready to fall apart at the moment you like look at them funny. So it's always a little bit scary to be messing with stuff. But yeah, I'm sure the people who are working in your house are glad that you had this little do-it-yourself project that you accomplished without them.
Yeah, I'm just not going to tell them.
Like, I mean, they're going to notice that the thermostat that they installed is no longer there and this new thing is.
Well, yeah, I guess they will. They will eventually see that.
What did you do with the old thermostat that you paid for, by the way?
I rested it on the floor below it and walked away.
I don't think they'd be like, oh, the thermostat fairy came in the night
and just set this down.
Yeah, you put on wooden shoes and it takes your old thermostat and puts them inside. I don't know what they're going to think. You need to communicate. I mean, I do feel like you should own up and say, yeah, so I'm a little bit of a do-it-yourselfer and only took me 3 trips to the hardware store to and 1 blown fuse, but I did it. So let me know if you need my help later.
I'm just glad that that was a fuse and that I didn't like fry the whole control board. That's
yeah,
what
well,
I was
that's
really
what fuses
afraid
are
of.
For, right? Yeah. You know, but I believe in you. You could have, if you had a coin, you could have bridged that fuse thing with a coin and then really blown the board.
Oh God!
It's the old thing is like, yeah, you don't need a fuse. Just sort of, you know, take some foil off your pack of Marlboros and put it in there.
Yeah, why? What do you need a fuse for? Just bypass it. I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah. Fuses are pointless anyway, right? Speaking of microwaves, I think that's one of the few things that did go wrong with microwaves. I do believe I blew a fuse at one point, like those microwave fuses, but and I don't know why, and I think I replaced it and it hasn't blown since in years, but yeah.
I still can't believe you're using a screenless microwave for all this time.
It's got a screen.
Well.
It doesn't work, but it's there.
I mean, it might as well not be there.
Yeah, well, no, it
has become screenless.
Yeah, I think it does. I think one of the 7 segments in one of the things lights up or something, like just one, like it never changes, but it's like always just anyway.
It doesn't like occasionally blink on, like, oh,
we
it's
don't,
a multiple
we don't talk about it. It's very sensitive about its screen, but we consider it a whole microwave.
Oh, jeez.
Although, the fan, now that we did that episode, I swear, after we did that episode, the fan is starting to sound, make noises. I'm like, did you hear the podcast, microwave? What are you doing?
Get the
breath. Like, and you're like, oh, it's just a vibration. Maybe if I touch it, oh, it went away. And so I'm giving this thing side eye now. And to be fair, already like the door opening closing was being wonky, which is why I had done that research that I referenced. But now, that we did that podcast, it's like, I heard you talking about me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hey, look, I know your wife listens to this podcast. I'm just saying, you know, both Christmas and your birthday are coming up.
Oh, she doesn't want a new microwave either. When I was doing microwave research, everyone I showed her, she's like, ew, I don't like that. What's wrong with our microwave? And
I mean,
it amazes me that she tolerates the lack of a screen.
Big things
too.
That are wrong with your microwave.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll see. But yeah, I do have my eye on that. I'm asking for so much kitchen stuff for my Christmas stuff, but it doesn't currently include a microwave.
Just 8 cheese graters.
Right. No, it is similar stuff like that. It's way cheaper than a microwave.
And a microwave on John's counter. That's the end of the song. Yeah. All right. Let's do titles.
All right. What do we got? I was so damn proud of myself when I got the thing working. Like, I was so ashamed when I broke it.
You had erased the memories of the previous failures. Like, this is a pure victory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This was worth like 2
flawless
hours.
Flawless execution.
Yeah.
I actually, a few months ago, I told myself I was going to replace the train thermostats that came with our redone HVAC that we did in 2014. I told myself I was going to replace them with like an Ecobee or something equivalent. And I looked specifically at the Ecobee and I wussed out because I don't think my HVAC is actually that unique. I'm just so scared that I'm going to screw something up.
You could totally do it. It'll be fine.
No, you could.
I mean, all these thermostats, the Ecobee and I imagine the Nest ones, they come with just such extensive instructions and like wizards to guide you through. And if you do not have a weird house, you'll be on one of those happy paths.
Yeah, I mean the fact that I was able to do it with almost no tools and, you know, and basically no relevant expertise except having done it a whole bunch in the past.
And well, the important thing, and I think this is where you went wrong, Marco, is assuming the installers had installed the one that they installed correctly, that is your key to understanding what all the wires do.
Yes.
Right.
Well, if they use the same letters on their
like, but that's the thing about the guides. They tell you like this may be Y1 on your thing or maybe R2 on this thing, and like they try to cover all the bases, and I you know, again, the historical baggage of USB is nothing compared to the letters that they assign to thermostat wires and the decades of history behind that only like these installers know, and that you don't even need to know the history. It's like, you just suffice it to say, you just have to know that R1 and R2 and Y and G and P and Q and the colors, and you know, it's once you know it, I'm sure it's fine, but you don't have to know all like the history behind it. But yeah, for yours, Casey, when you take the worst mistake you can do is take off your other one. Okay, old thing, take it off, and then just be left with a bunch of wires in your face. You made a big mistake there. Take a picture of the back of the old one first. So, worst case, you can always put the old one back exactly the way it was, because, and then label the wires. If you have two wires that are the same color, label them. Put a little piece of tape around them, label them, you know. They give you that with the kits. If you buy one of these things, like the Eco thing, comes with little tiny tags to put on the wires.
Yeah.
So you don't, because they know you're going to lose track of the two, you know, both of the, in my case, all the wires are the color of ash, right? In my walls, right? They're just all ash gray, or they're space black, Apple would call it. Right, so you have to label them because they literally all look identical. They all look like they've been in a fire, and they all look identical. So they give you stickers with the thermostat to put on your little wires because they know you're going to forget. So I believe in you, Casey. Unlike the fiber optic thing, I think you can do the the thermostat replacement.
I don't know. My system isn't that unique, but it's
you have
pump.
9 connected wires here. Oh wait, one of them's a loop. What the heck is this?
It's fine. Look how easy this is. He's got, these are huge fat wires with plenty of slack and gigantic connectors. This is like glory. You should see the back of the Ecobee thing is like doing microsurgery compared to this.
Yeah,
well,
yeah, that's true.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, this would be fine. The bigger problem is you'd have to use one of those ugly big plate covers to cover up the...
Oh, no, look at the size of it. His hole is small there. Like, he just... Oh, I guess he had the screws. Yeah. No, yeah. I think this is, we're zoomed in pretty far here. I think he could get away with, I think a Nest might span those two Phillips screws right and left.
No, and also the problem is Nest mounts on top and bottom. So you could use that bottom screw. You have to drill a new one in the top and you have to seal up the left and right ones. But you could do it. It's not any harder than like changing a light switch. It's actually easier because you're dealing with
Look at yours are separate colors. You see the jumper between RH and RC with the red one going into RC. Like that's the tricky stuff that would be a pain for you to figure it out on your own. But here it is. You got the key. Like assuming these labels are correct, which they probably are.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm not mentioning
and you have a common wire.
Yeah.
Which is blue, just like my new one.
So in theory, you know, even if I really hosed it up, we're friendly with our HVAC installer. Like we talk to them periodically. Just
why don't you just have them do it?
Well, I should, but
you can do it yourself way cheaper.
I
think it's worth trying it yourself, right? Exactly. And then you can call him and say, "Hey, I tried to do it myself and I screwed it up. Save me."
Yeah, I gotta say, the process of installing the Nests and using the Nests, it's a lot nicer than the Echo Bee. Like they're both easy, but the Nest is nicer now. I know Nest's whole backing service is, you know, slowly being neglected by Google, and I know that it doesn't have HomeKit
Google
support.
Abandoning a product? No.
But like the actual experience of physically using it is so much nicer than Echo Bee. It's not even close. Like that's I know it's annoying to have to go into the dumb Nest app or have to run some kind of Homebridge kind of thing.
Why are you doing either one of those things? Like, not that I agree with you. I think the Ecobee's interface is terrible, but like once you get it set up, like are you constantly like micromanaging it to tweak it up and down?
Wonder.
Up and down, not occasionally, yes. I also turn it on and off a lot, like you know, especially in transitional.
Well,
seasons
yeah,
like
you're not at the house, but even, well, yeah.
Oh no,
I guess
even just like you know, like what it like earlier this week, it was super sunny and bright during the day, and then freezing at night. So during the day, I actually wanted to open some of the windows upstairs because it was so warm and the sun was coming in, and so I turned all the heat off in the middle of the day, and then later on that night, turn it back on like that. That
but,
kind
but
of stuff.
Why do you need to turn it off? Why don't you just like. Let the heat won't come on unless it needs to come on. Like you're going for a target temperature, right? You're not going for heat on or heat off.
But I didn't want a situation where like I open the windows, it goes 1 degree below my set point, and then the heat's blasting with the windows open. I wanted to avoid that.
But then it would stop as soon as it got back. Like it's just a thermostat. That's what it does. Well, like it's gonna anyway.
Also, like you know, we do workouts in the house. We do FaceTime workouts with a trainer, and so like I'll turn the heat way down, you know, a few hours ahead.
Oh,
of that.
You need focus modes for HomeKit. It's like when I'm in a workout focus mode, turn the temperature in the house down.
Yeah, but it has to be like earlier than that. It's a whole thing. We tweak it all the time. We're like, you know, hey, some nights you're a little cold, and you want to turn up the bedroom like 1 or 2 degrees. Some nights you're really hot, you want to turn it down a few degrees. Like that's just what happens, you know. So anyway. I like having, that's the whole point of thermostats, you can adjust them! And every smart thermostat I've ever seen that wasn't a Nest was just a horrendous interface to actually just, let me just raise lower the temperature 1 degree or so, like that's, oh god, it's so hard on everything else. And I don't know, like Echo Bee has blown it so hard. They have some of the pieces in place to be really amazing, and they just blow it on minor design choices.
I think that some of that is, some of the, the lack of HomeKit integration, the fact they want to use your own app, I consider that a feature. Because I enjoy my thermostat not being connected to that ecosystem, which I have found not to be particularly reliable. So I like that my Ecobee has no idea about that other stuff. I disable the thing that lets it use Siri or whatever. That's what it kind of attracts me to the Ecobee, is that it is less smart. And I don't want it to be particularly smart. I want it to be straightforward, and I set it and forget it. And yeah, that's basically, and obviously my needs are less demanding. How many thermostats do I have announced? Just the one. Actually, not true. There's a thermostat in this room that controls only this room, and then there's one for the whole rest of the house.
I mean, that's actually a great setup. For that one room, that's nice, really nice.
It is. I mean, it's because this was the thing they have in New England that you may not be familiar with, called a three-season porch, mm-hmm. which is a terrible name for a part of your house that isn't built as well as the rest of it. It's built like a California house.
Yeah, it's basically built like a deck that they put walls and a roof around.
But it's a little bit more than that, because it's three seasons, not two seasons, right? You just can't use it in the winter, in theory. But anyway, sometime in the 80s, the people who had this house before us walled this in and made it an actual four-season room in the house, which is kind of weird. The door to this room that I'm in used to be essentially an exterior door, so it's built like an exterior door, which is super weird, but that's tons of New England houses like this. Anyway, when they did that, they're like, oh, and now we need heat in this room. And so they put heat in this room, and only in this room, with its very own thermostat. It's so weird, but it is kind of convenient.
Titles. I like Market Your Bug, which I suggested. I like the Thermostat Fairy.
Market Your Bug is my favorite, I think.
That is pretty good. Let's see what else. I do like Too Big to Fit on a Baby. That's almost like a You Look Nice Today title.
Which one?
Too Big to Fit on a
Too
Baby.
Too Big to Fit on a Baby.
The current title.
No, Market, it's got to be Market Your Bug, right?
I think so.
Yeah, probably.
Going to the robot.
Cool. All right.
The thermostat for this room, by the way, it's one of those ones with the coil of metal wire, like the old round ones that you would see in school when you guys were in school.
With the mercury blob inside?
No, not the mercury blob, but I can't say that. Maybe it does have the mercury in the capsules. I haven't looked inside.
You should pop it open. Usually,
but I think
that,
it's just
that
got
coil
the
of wire. Like at
I think
the
it's
end
just got
it
the bimetallic strip curly thing. But it's so super old. It's not smart. I guess you didn't. But it's real easy to change the temperature. You just turn the dial.
Yeah, that was what Nest did. Nest, for all of Google's mishandling of this company, their thermostat is very nice to use. It's nicer to look at, way nicer to look at than the Ecobee's. The Ecobee's not ugly, but the Nest is just way nicer. And it's so much nicer to actually physically use. It's not even close. And it is kind of sad when you look around the thermostat industry how few nice options there are. There's just not anything nice except Nest and a little bit Ecobee. And everything else is crappy industrial garbage.
Anyway. Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, I've been flirting with the idea of Ecobees, but
after sales pitch here,
I mean, honestly, I want nothing to do with Nest. Everything I've understood, everything I've understood is that everything around the physical, and I mean, this is
a
different.
I think you mean Google Home?
Well, that too.
That stupid transition that I have one Google Home camera and two Nest cameras and mm-hmm. and two different apps. It's not great over there.
Anyway, yeah, but my understanding is exactly what Marco said. The physical interaction with Nest is great. Everything else is just utter shit. And I don't know. No, thank you. And so what is the other choices? Ecobee. There's your other choice. That's all you got.
I think Ecobee.
Not more of these after all these years?
If you are a set it and forget, there are more. The traditional companies all have quote-unquote smarter thermostats now, but I feel like they are less good than the Ecobee. Ecobee is a nice medium between ones that have just a plain LCD screen with that isn't bitmap based. It's just, again, a bunch of little things. Those ones, there's ones with e-ink screens. Then there's the full-fledged Nest ones. Ecobee is kind of in that middle spot, which I think is kind of a good place to be. But if you don't like that, you can buy for basically the same amount of money or more than an Ecobee, one of the ones from traditional thermostat companies like Honeywell and stuff.
That's what
I've got. They look janky, but they have all the same features as Ecobee, but their app is 100 times worse, but they'll probably also last longer. One of the things I did was, and I was just as too, Casey, when you take out your old one, the one that was here, save it. right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I absolutely would.
And
yeah,
put
yeah.
it somewhere and keep everything, all the parts with it and labeled or whatever. Because, like, if you ever, well, if you had winter and then you lost heat in the middle of that winter because your stupid smart thing died or got bricked by a software update, it's so handy to be able to just look at this picture, bring out the old one, now you're back up and running. And those old ones just do not die. Like my one that I replaced, it was powered by a single AA battery that lasted like 7 years. Like it just has, it has an up and a down button, a plus and a minus button, and like a VCR type scheduler. They are just bulletproof. And so definitely save your old one.
Well, I agree with the broad strokes of what you're saying, but this is not a joke. About a week ago, I had to kill the breaker to the thermostat downstairs because Aaron does occasionally fiddle with them. I almost never touch them, but Aaron will occasionally fiddle with them. And she was complaining, justifiably, she was complaining that it took her forever to change the temperature on this thing. And it's a touchscreen and so on and so forth.
It's a touchscreen. Well, that's pretty modern already. Like,
it's 2014.
That's what I'm saying. Like, that's what these all suck at. Changing the temperature.
Hold on. Just hold on.
What else are you doing with a thermostat?
No, but it gets better. Because what I ended up doing was throwing the breaker to the thermostat, which of course killed to the furnace, which killed the thermostat. Gave it a 5 count, turned it back on. And you know what suddenly was way more performant and was much faster I guess whatever friggin' memory leak had been cleaned? My thermostat. So, yeah, it's great, except that it has a friggin' memory leak.
Yeah, you don't have one of the old reliable ones. I was thinking powered by a AA battery with rubbery buttons and no smarts. But
yeah, those things last forever.
Yeah, this is not what I have. And I mean, the one that I have, you can control via a truly terrible app, which is nice, but it's a truly terrible app. There are like three of these apparently in the world, and so I haven't yet found a Homebridge plugin for it. I actually have a search running periodically to see if eventually one pops up, and it hasn't in the literally 6 years that I've had this search running or something like that. I want to get rid of it, and I kind of want an Ecobee, but I'm scared of it, and so I haven't. And they're expensive, and so that's why I haven't done it yet. To answer the chat room's question, we are doing Mondays, next two Mondays. Obviously, there's Thanksgiving holiday for next week, and then there's some travel for some of us the week following. So the next two Mondays at 8 p.m. Eastern is what we're doing.
Yeah, so same regular time, but Monday is the day.
Right. Oh, and this is 100% got mercury in it, John.
That's not the mine from the wall because I can't reach it with my headphones on, but that's more or less what it looks like.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the old round inside. Honeywell with the heat on top and the cooling on the bottom or whatever. Or no, that's
not cooling. That's just saying what the current temperature is.
That's right.
Is.
Heat and cool is a switch on the side usually. Well, you don't have cooling on you.
I don't have any cooling. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
My thermostats essentially connect one wire to the other. That is the sole function.
Yeah.
Because there's only one thing you can do is either heat on or heat off. That's it.
Yeah. This is exactly what we had in my house growing up, just with cooling also.
Yeah. But you can change temperature real easy. You just turn that dial. That's it.
Yeah. Exactly. That's what the Nest was ripping off. Because that's literally the Nest was designed after all the digital ones had come out that all had these complicated button things. And Tony Fadell was like, hey, what if we just made this a knob? It's nicer, like the old ones. Boop, you just turn it. And everyone's like, oh my god, that's amazing. And look, you made a round screen.
Late 2023 is the year of the knob for Marco.
Wow. Crazy.
All right, British. We already established this.
All right. We going to bed?
Yeah. Thanks, live people. This was fun. And we'll see you on Monday. So, see
you. Indeed. Bye.